We're working on an intro. I got the person I had on yesterday, Jason. He wants to make me a God damn it, an intro. He wants to make me an intro, and I kind of like just starting the podcast and just saying I don't have an intro. That's my intro. That's how I've even with my solo content, I was like, hello, good morning, welcome to another episode of Cushion Coffee. All right, let's start. Like, I don't know. I'm just not geared for intros. I don't even know if there's a gear for intros, but we'll get there eventually.
I understand. So while we're practicing, I'm just like, hey, here I am.
Yeah, right. Here I am. If you don't know me, get to know me. This is what I do, right?
Yeah. You have any questions? Like, what brings you here?
Right. So tell me a little bit about yourself, Jonathan Whitehawk. Well, first, so how do you get that name? We'll start there.
Well, during my apprenticeship, we were told to pick a name, a working name, when we're doing spiritual work, derived from nature. And one of my guides is a Native American from Utah. Wow. His name was Red Hawk. So that's where I got the hawk from. Mm-hmm. And the shaman I learned from, her working name was Al Whitefeather. And so I took White from her name and Hawk from my own spirit guide's name and put them together. And that was how I got White Hawk.
Wow. I love it. I love the name, actually.
Yeah, and it's weird because I never really thought of Hawk as anything I'd be associated with. When I first started getting into spirituality in itself and connecting with my higher self was in 2005, and we did a power animal meditation, and I found a polar bear. It's like that makes sense for me because I like to be in the cold, you know. I'm very curious, and you know, I'm very, very calm, but just let me be, you know. Don't poke the bear.
Right.
So I never would have thought of Hawk myself, normally. When I was first thinking of a name, I was like, well, how can I incorporate polar bear into a name? Like, that's kind of, you know, I don't want to be Jonathan Polar Bear. That doesn't really sound nice. And White Hawk just kind of came to me.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I was, I listened to a lot of, I don't know, on Spotify, it's called Native American Flute Orchestra. And I like some of the names that pop up are just amazing. One of my favorite artists is Douglas Bluefeather. He does amazing flute work, and it's just I love it. So yeah, tell me a little bit more about how like you get into something like that.
Well, I'll tell you how I got started from the beginning.
Yeah. Tell me your beginning.
And that was in 2005. The girl I was just dating broke up with me, and one of my friends, her boyfriend worked at Sears as like their handyman guy, and one of the guys he worked with was going to these meditations, and he knew that his girlfriend, who was my friend, was into this. So he told her, she's like, hey, we're going to this meditation, you should come. And I took my mom with me because my mom was also very open to this stuff. And we both went, and we went to see Robert Eggby, who is apparently a fairly well-known psychic medium, and he was living in Westville, New Jersey. And we went to his house for a guided meditation. He took us to our sacred spot, which is, anytime you go into meditation, you just go somewhere that is your place. It's, you control the environment, you control what you see, who's allowed in there. And for me, it was in the Adirondacks. When I was in the Boy Scouts, around 14, 15, we did a hike to this beautiful lake up in the Adirondacks, and that's where I went. And I was sitting on this boulder in the middle of the lake, and I just felt this white light come around me. And I felt so at peace. And when I came out of that meditation, I knew that everything would be okay. And, you know, my girlfriend broke with me the day before, and I was completely at peace and okay with it. I was like, all right, well, there is something to this.
Wow.
And slowly, like every week, we started doing more meditations. And I was only 22 at the time, so I was kind of coming and going here and there. I wasn't doing every week, because really every group you go to is usually about 20 women over 40, and that's about it. And as a 22-year-old guy, I'm like, I'm not gonna spend my Tuesday nights hanging out in a room full of old ladies. You know, I want to go out with my friends and hang out with my friends. And but I was still going from time to time. My mom was going regularly. And we just kind of fell into this group of people in this area who were different energy workers. And, you know, at some point, one of them taught my mom Reiki, who taught, when my mom became a Reiki master, she taught me Reiki. Mm-hmm. And I got a little bit more involved in some of the groups too, with some Reiki shares here and there. And then one day I got an email from this lady, Mary I, out in Mullica Hill, who runs Sunshine Learning Center. And I was like, there's a shamanic apprenticeship starting. And my wife and I had just bought our house. We had a 18-month-old daughter. We had another baby on the way. I looked at my wife, I'm like, can I do this? Mm-hmm. I was like, well, can we afford it? I'm like, we can definitely afford it, but this takes a lot of dedication.
Right.
You know, you have to be okay with me leaving the house several times a month for hours to do this. And it's like, if you feel like you need to do it. And, you know, I did my apprenticeship, and not long before I started I finished my apprenticeship, I started calling up my friends who I knew were into energy work and just open spirituality in general. Like, hey, I need people to practice on. And the practice never really kind of stopped. It just kind of kept going. And I just started finding people who were coming to me through word of mouth, and I just fell into it, so to speak. You know, it wasn't something I was necessarily looking for. It really kind of found me.
Well, that's an amazing story. Absolutely. Now, you spoke real quick about Reiki. Tell me a little bit about that.
Reiki is a Japanese healing modality. It was founded somewhere, I want to say around 1900. I don't remember the exact history off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of people out there who were like, well, this is what it is. But
and we're not going to worry about them, the elitists.
But, yeah. There's always someone out there.
And tell me what your definition of Reiki is.
Reiki is the universal healing energy. Everything is made up of energy, and Reiki is that energy. And we channel it from the universe through ourselves to whoever we're working on, or whoever we're sending it to.
Hmm.
And because it is the universal life energy, and that's what Reiki actually translates to, literally is universal life energy. It has its own intelligence, and it goes into the body where it needs to go. And it helps where it needs to help. It, mm-hmm. you know, it will not harm if it's not needed somewhere. It will go where it is, wherever it is needed.
Could it present itself as harm in a lesson, per se?
It can bring up old traumas and old emotions that people may not want to be. They may not want to deal with.
Right.
But it brings up in a much more subtle and gentle way than just, here's that traumatic experience all over again.
Right.
It might trigger some memories. It might trigger some emotions or dreams. And it tries to do it in a way that makes it much easier for us to process. But some people don't want to process even that little bit, and they consider that as harmful. But, you know, it's real work. it requires you to do as much work as the work it does, especially to meet it halfway. So, if you're coming in for Reiki work, be prepared to have some things surface that you're gonna need to process. And if you don't, you can actually get what they call a healing crisis. And you can get sick if you keep trying to hold on to the same old emotions that are trying to be released. I have seen it happen with clients of mine when I was first started doing Reiki, and people were just kind of getting, and my own friends were just kind of getting into this. And tell them, hey, these things are come up. Make sure you drink plenty of water. Stay away from alcohol. Your body's gonna need time to process and digest what's going on, and it's gonna want to expel some toxins. And they don't heed the warning, and you can get sick. You can be vomiting. You can have diarrhea. You can feel like you get a flu. It really kind of manifests in different ways for each person. But that's also your body telling you, hey, you have work to be done.
Right.
Do it. Listen, we don't want this in here any more than you want to deal with it.
So how would you start a Reiki session?
So a Reiki session usually starts by I clear myself energetically. I will smudge myself. I use a mix of sage and Palo Santo and sweetgrass in my smudge bowl, and I light it and let it burn, and I clear spread the smoke over myself. I'll run it over the client. I'll have them lay on a massage table, and then I'll use symbols that I was given when I was attuned to Reiki to call in the energy and activate the energy and send it where it needs to go. And then I'll just place my hands on the person, and it is a hands-on healing modality. Once you feel the energy flow, I just kind of close my eyes and let the energy and spirit guide me where I need to go. There's they have like suggested, times like place your hands here, here, and here. But as you start doing the work and you get used to the energy, you kind of develop your own way. And each time someone comes in, it's a little different because the energy responds to who you're working on. And it kind of guides you in that way.
How since you said it's hands on, that would make some people with some traumas not willing. Have you ever come in contact with that or
I haven't. Most of the time, I actually try to hover my hands above my clients.
okay.
I am an ordained minister, and I have started my own church, and that does allow me to place my hands on people without needing to be a doctor or a massage therapist.
Right.
But most of the time, I tell people, you're gonna feel my hands on you. If I put my hands anywhere that is not comfortable, or there's a spot that you don't want me touching, let me know now. Or when my hands are there, let me know. I will move them. I won't be offended. It's you have to be comfortable.
Right.
If my hands are somewhere you're like, I don't want them there, not a big deal. But most of the time, I just hover my hands above the client. If I place my hands on them, she's on their heads or their arms or their feet. Once you get to the torso, I kind of leave my hands hovering because some people they don't like hand contact anywhere.
Right.
Other people just don't mind, but
Yeah.
I try to nullify the whole thing and just hover my hands.
No, that makes sense. That's a great idea. If someone doesn't want to be tied, have you ever come in contact with someone that was just that told you staunchly, don't touch me at all? I want to do this, but just please don't touch me.
I have not.
No.
Most people, and my wife included, have a like their neck is sensitive, and they don't want anything near their neck. Which, my wife, if you get near her neck, she will swing at you. So, and I so when I have clients, I'm like, look, I already have this experience. Like, I know this is a thing. And I do have a few other clients that come in who don't like hands near their neck. And that's been the only spot that people have told me so far that they don't want my hands. And that's, I
Makes
get it.
sense. Makes sense. Yeah, absolutely. Tell me a little bit about I've been reading your service list here, and that article you sent me, both very interesting pieces. I've been looking at this guided journey. You want to tell me? Well, no, actually, first, before that, can you tell me some examples of spiritual drains?
Spiritual dreams are dreams like where you feel like you're flying. If you feel like you are, I used to have dreams where I felt like I was like bungee jumping, where I felt like I was on something and I started going from the air, and I started bouncing back and forth between the ground and up in the air. And every time I went up in the air, I was getting higher and higher. And that's actually your spirit trying to leave your body to journey. Other spiritual dreams are like if you have a dream that, like when you wake up, you're like, that dream felt so real, like I was there. Well, that is a spiritual dream. That is your body, your spirit leaving your body and traveling. And you had a real experience. And that is why that can feel so real. A lot of times people have that when they, a loved one has passed, they'll have a dream. They'll like, I know I felt them. Like I saw them. I hugged them. I could feel it. Well, that was them coming to visit you, or you going to visit them. That was a real experience because it's just energy. Your energy left and met another energy, and that was that. Some dreams come as kind of come as premonitions, and you'll see stuff that, like, wow, that I know that area. That dream felt really real, even though I may not have been a part of it, but that what I saw felt real, or just it sticks in your head. You wake up and you like you have this dream that you can't seem to forget, where other dreams you wake up and like, I had a dream. I couldn't tell you what the fuck happened, but I had a dream. And when you have dreams, you're like, well, this happened and it's been days later. I still remember the dream vividly clear. Well, that was another spiritual dream. There's a message there for you. Something there to get your attention. And that's why it sticks so profoundly in your memory for any length of time. I had a dream when I was 4 years old that I was guiding people through a house while we're being chased by something. I didn't know what it was. And I remember being able to see the thing looking for us while I was not even in my body, while hiding under stairs and moving people, like sneaking around when I knew the coast was clear because they were off somewhere else looking for us. And, I am now almost 40 years old and I still remember the dream just as vividly clear as I had it, 35 years ago.
Oh shit. See, I've had something similar only the year or so after I lost one of my closest friends. I consider him my brother. I lost him to suicide, and I don't know, I wouldn't feel his energy near me at certain times. However, when I would dream, I feel like I was there with him on some level, but I feel like there was a disconnect because my spirit was attempting to make contact. Like I remember trying to talk, to scream, to yell, but obviously unable to because, when your spirit travels, there's, vocals aren't coming with it. I'm guessing like maybe some reflection or distant memory of it, or just the only way of being able to contact or connect with another person. I'm not entirely sure, but it made me freak out only because I couldn't talk and he was just so calm. He was very just like he almost knew that we couldn't talk to each other, but the only way to be with each other was to just be there and coexist.
Just to sit with them.
Yeah.
A lot of times that's because the response is so strong that even your body, while your body's asleep, is trying to respond with your spirit. And because your body's asleep, none of that stuff is working. You can have dreams where when you get used to them, because that's also kind of some people call that lucid dreaming. You get used to them, you learn how to control all aspects of your body even while you're asleep. But yeah, that's a very common thing. I used to have a lot of dreams like that where I would be somewhere and I couldn't move my hands, or I really felt like I was severely handicapped in my participation in the dream and what I wanted to do, and it could be very frustrating. I had a friend who I lost to suicide, questionable suicide, 13 years ago, and I had a dream, probably about 5 years ago now. I was driving down a road in Virginia at my uncle's house, and this friend grew up in National Park, New Jersey, so no connection to Virginia at all. But for some reason, this dream, we're in Virginia, and And I got out of the car and I saw him and I gave him this giant hug and he was like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Man, I haven't seen you in years." I'm like, "I just saw you a couple of days ago." I'm like, "Dude, you've been dead 6 years. I haven't seen you."
Oh,
like, I didn't just see you a couple of days ago. But you know, in spirit time, that's when time's eternity. There is no, you know, what we think is a couple of days for them is like a blink of an eye. When, you know, what they think is just a couple of days for us could be decades.
Right.
You know, it gets very kind of convoluted with time because time is really just a human construct. It's not, it doesn't exist in the spirit realm.
Right. Wow. Similarly, I'd like to know a couple examples of spiritual drains instead of, you know what I'm saying? You glossed over it quickly a little bit earlier. You said drains. I'm guessing those are spiritual drains. It's something that drains your energy.
Things that drain your energy. Well, there's a lot of things I can. Dreams or drains?
Drains. Sorry about
drains.
That. Yeah, no, we were talking about dreams, and I asked only because you said it earlier that sometimes there are you know, in addition to other things, there was drains.
Yeah, well, spiritual drains are
maybe old traumas, past traumas can be a drain.
Yeah,
if you don't, you know,
old things, new things. Every single time we make a connection with someone, you talk to someone walking down the street, you make a connection with them, and people can drain you. Some people are psychic vampires, and just, you know, if you find someone who's like, "I feel really good when I'm around you," well, that person's probably draining you. They may not be aware of it. Some people are aware of it. I did know someone who was aware that they were doing that, and they would do it intentionally. They would go around people that knew they felt better when they're around because they were usually empathic people. And you leave them hanging out with them, and you're like, "Man, I'm just so tired and worn out." There's that kind of, there's drains like that. You know, being just where you don't take care of yourself, you get caught up in work, can drain you because you're not, you know, you get too stressed, and you get stressed, the first thing we forget to do is take care of ourselves. We focus on the stress and not ourselves, and that can drain you because, you know, we are a mind, body, spirit person, and, you know, we have to take care of all three.
Right.
You know, and there are traumatic things that can happen to us that we get stuck focusing on that can drain us. A lot, you know, very similar to depression. Depression drains you, and when you get in like a depressed state, you don't take care of yourself, you know, physically, you're not taking yourself mentally, you're not taking yourself spiritually. It happened to myself. You know, my brother, lost my brother a couple of years ago.
Wow.
To cancer, and you know, that was right at in the middle of me getting my spiritual practice started. And you know, I did all right for 6 months after he passed, keep myself together. And then I just kind of collapsed because I was trying to run from the pain. And, you know, it caught up with me and I felt a deep depression. I was not doing my spiritual practices I was doing regularly because I don't, you know, I tell people they should do them daily because we all should do something daily. But I do most of my stuff a few times a week. And even that started falling to the side. And I felt like I could barely move most of the time. I was getting up and going to work. Boy, I come home from work and I would just sit in the couch and do nothing because I felt I had zero energy left to give.
Wow.
And, you know, I kind of had to force myself to like, all right, let me start doing what I know to do to kind of get myself better. And it took me about a year and a half or so to kind of get myself halfway back to where I was. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, those traumatic experiences can drain you if you don't deal with them properly and promptly, you know, in a way that works for you. If you just try to run from it and like, well, this, you know, right. I'll deal with it when it, I'll let time pass and I'll deal with it later. Well, that, you know, your body and your psyche and your spirit, you know, they want you to deal with things right away. They don't want to hold on to things because that is, you know, it's draining you. It's, there's a connection there. There's emotions coming out. There's stuff coming out of you. And it's just, slowly leaching out of you until there's nothing left.
Yeah, I feel like that's the easiest way to sell, I guess, spiritual strength is self-discipline, because self-discipline and spiritual growth work basically hand in hand. If you don't think about spirituality and you don't really dive into it, however you practice firm self-discipline, you are in fact feeding your spirit and you don't even know it.
Yeah.
So
no, you absolutely are. Because nothing really feels better than doing something for yourself,
Right.
But yet it's the hardest thing for us to do.
Right. And in turn, if we do for ourselves a lot better, we can do for others a lot better.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of like if you're a glass of water and you pour half your glass out to help other people, but you never refill yourself, you know, the next time people need help, well, you don't have as much to give.
Right.
So you have to take care of yourself first, you know, so the better you take care of yourself, the better off you are, and the better you are of a person, you're in a better spot. You feel like you're in a better spot emotionally, mentally, like you handle stress better, you handle life better in general. Like you can roll the punches easier when you are in a good spot and you're taking care of yourself. You know, you don't get derailed as easily. And that does take self-discipline, because even when you don't feel like it, you have to get up and do the work that you know you need to do. You know, whether that's getting up in the morning and working out, or get up in the morning and have a little meditation, like whatever it is that you do, or whatever that you need to do, because it's different for each person as well. There are some people who, like, their self-discipline and spirituality are tied in with going for walks in the woods. There are other people who, they can go to the gym for an hour, run on a treadmill, and they hit that zen spot because they're draining the body energetically, and they can just focus on one thing. Their mind can wander, and that can be their spiritual practice. And if that feeds their soul, then that is their spiritual practice. You know, it's not always sitting around by candlelight meditating.
Right.
You know, that doesn't work for every person. You know, that's works for most people, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's what's best for most people. It's just something that works. It's a tool. You know, and self-discipline. You know, there's no one waking me up in the morning telling me to come over here and light my candles and smudge myself and say my little prayers. You know, that's all on me, and it's up to me whether I do it or not. And you know, that takes dedication. That does take, you know, you have to force yourself to do it, or you know, remind yourself or do something, because there's, you know, without it, I'm not going to be any better off than I would be before. I'm not going to be in a different spot. You know, I have a girl that's came in for meditations in the last 2 weeks, and you know, she's new to this stuff, and I like to tell them, like I was telling her, you know, you're going to hear from a lot of people about how to do things, but you need to find what works for you. You know, take a little bit from this, a little bit from that person, find what works for you, because what calls you is easier for you to do. You know, I'm not a runner, so I'm not going to get up in the morning and go for a nice 1 hour long morning jog. I'm not.
Yeah.
I have no desire to. You know, years ago, I was up living in North Jersey for a while, and I got into rock climbing, and that really actually worked for me. One of my most zen moments that I've ever had in my life, I finished doing this climb, and I came back down, and I sat there looking at the wall. I just climbed, drinking my water, and, you know, if I could have died in that moment, I would have been absolutely okay with it. I had such a feeling of peace, such a feeling of peace after that. Like while sitting there, I was like, "Man, this," and you know, that really, when I was up there, that was what was feeding my soul. That was what was keeping me going spiritually.
Wow.
Because you know, I'm the kind of person, I need a physical drain as well as I need my spirituality kind of connected. And I've always been drawn to physical work because I'm a high energy person, and if I don't drain my body, I get really bad anxiety. You know, I had to drain that excess energy somewhere. I never stopped moving. You know, my wife gets irritated sometimes because even while I'm sleeping, while I'm falling asleep, I'm shaking my feet, you know, shaking my legs. I never stop moving. So I need that physical drain to be able to get myself in a spot where I can sit down and do my own spiritual work and, you know, focus my brain, 'cause my body needs that release. There are other people who don't need that release. You know, they can sit there all day long and meditate or focus on something, and that works for them. You know, and they can, you know, and I envy those people. I wish I could just wake up and sit somewhere and like, yeah, I'm going to sit here and do this all day long. It just does not work for me. You
Right.
know, I need to be up and active for my self-discipline. That's where my self-discipline kicks in. I need to make sure I get up and do something physical before I do something spiritual, because it works better for me. I can be in a calmer spot to calm my mind and my body.
Wow. Something physical before something spiritual. I like that formula. I like
Yeah,
that.
that was what works for me.
Yeah. I'm similar. I am a high powered machine, so I have to go work off some energy first before I allow other people to deal with me. Because if I
Yeah.
don't do it, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare for me and everyone else involved. And you know, I mean, I for so long I didn't know. You know, who knew? Who fucking knew?
Yeah.
In a world where self-discipline is not a traditional or cultural norm by any stretch of the imagination. It's kind of difficult to, you know, to do something like that, to learn yourself, especially if you're high powered and you have a lot of energy and you're not, you know, and you have a bunch of people around you that may not know how to deal with that or don't have the self-discipline or the self-awareness to learn how to deal with it themselves. You know?
Yeah, I feel bad for kids these days, because these days, you know, we force kids to sit in school all day long, you know, and the teacher's like, well, you can't sit still, put them on medicine because they have ADD or ADHD.
Yeah.
Well, that might not be what that kid actually has. That kid might just need to go for a 3-hour run, you know, and get the energy out, and then they'll sit as calm as can be. We don't, you know, but we don't teach kids, hey, find out what you need to do for yourself.
Right.
Let's work with you to figure out what needs to happen for you to get yourself in a spot where you can sit here and learn and be open to things. Like, what do you need first? You know, we don't do that. We're just like, you sit here, you're not doing what we want you to do, take some pills. You
Right.
know, don't learn about yourself. Let's just keep covering up the problem.
And
You know,
then
and
if you don't listen or take the pills, you're subject to become to being in trouble. In
yeah.
trouble. In social trouble. And then after, I don't know, 18 to 22 years of that shit from school and your parents, you're set off into a self-governing society that doesn't make any fucking sense. You, every
Yeah.
single person comes from an authoritarian background and thrust into a self-governing society. And you wonder why things are happening the way it's happening. The formula
Yeah,
just
why
doesn't make any sense.
why do I feel like I'm floundering? Well, because you were never taught how to do any of this stuff on your own. You know,
Right.
you were taught to follow instructions and how to be a good little factory worker, and never taught how to, you know, how to construct your own life in a way that works for you. You were taught, well, this is what we do. You know, you get up in the morning, you get dressed, you go to this room, you sit here for 8 hours, and then you go home and you live your life. You know, and we're never taught, you know, get up, take care of yourself, figure out what you want to do, go do what you need to do, and then come back and make your life work around that. You know, we're always taught your life works around this chunk of time where you spent listening to someone else doing what they want you to do,
Right.
not how do you make your life work and then make life your work fit into your life. You know, it's never the other way around. And I'm kind of going through that right now, because I just left my day job a couple months ago, and I told my wife, you know, for the first time in my life, I have to figure out how to structure my life. My life has always been structured for me, because I've always had a job. I've always had two jobs since I was 16 years old until now. And so I've always had other people tell me what I needed to do. I was accountable to other people, never been accountable to just myself.
Right.
And for the first time in my life, I am accountable to myself. I'm like, fuck, how do I do this? I have no idea. I've always got up and worked for other people, and that's been fine. And I've always been good at self-managing myself while I've been at work. I'm a very hands-off employee. When I work for someone, tell me what you need, let me be, I'm good. But when it comes to doing it for myself, like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I feel like I am learning how to live all over again, because I'm like, I don't know how to structure my life in a way that works for me, because I've never had to do it.
Yeah. We don't teach each other how to do it. And the people that know how to do it, they don't teach other people how to do it, because we don't listen. Nobody listens. You can say it. You can be like, hey, you can do this, this, and this if you do this, this, and this. And then the other person's like, or I could just sit here,
Yeah.
I could just not, And that's the thing about the C mentality. It's C is average, right? C, you needed a C to graduate high school, graduate middle school. You didn't have to get an A. You didn't have to get an A plus. You didn't have to fight for honors or valedictorian. You didn't have to do any of that.
There was no, you didn't need to push yourself to excel. You just had to do the bare minimum. What's the bare minimum I need to do? All right, I'll do that.
And there are so many, there's more people that do the bare minimum or just pass or get passed because the school doesn't want to deal with them. How many times have we seen that?
And that unfortunately sets up a lot of other stumbling blocks for later in life, because there's never going to be someone out there really telling you what you need to do to push yourself, except for the few people who do, and you're like, yeah, I'm not doing that, because you just dismiss them, because you're like, been shown why push myself would be a good thing, how it can actually help me further in life. I've just been shown, well, you push yourself, you can get a little better job, where you do a little bit more work and make some more money.
Yeah.
All right, well, if I do this, I can get along. I can get by just fine. I'll get some mediocre money and a mediocre life, but I'm okay with that because that's basically what I've been groomed for my whole life.
Right. I'm making $40,000 through hard work and excellence. I can make $80,000 in 10 years.
Yeah.
It was a difficult journey for me to learn this. And I made a lot of mistakes on the way. And anybody that does learn self-awareness and independence has to make a lot of mistakes on the way. And it really doesn't have to be like that. I'm not going to lie to you. It doesn't have to be this difficult to learn independence. It's because we have this lopsided formula of, strict parenting into a free society. It makes employees. That's what you're making. You're making employees.
Yeah, you're making people who follow instructions, who don't really think for themselves, who aren't out there asking questions, because that part's killed right off the bat. How many of us heard our whole lives, well, we don't ask questions like that. There are no stupid questions, but that question you just asked, that is stupid. We don't ask questions like that. I'm like, well, no, if there are no stupid questions, then no matter how ridiculous the question might be, you should always answer it, because you don't know what that kid is thinking. But that's what happens to all of us. We all get, we have this independent, curious drive. I see it in my own kids. They ask 1,000 questions and they never stop. And it can be frustrating and it can be hard to deal with, because the questions do come rapid fire. But, that's all through life. You have questions and people start like, so you stop asking questions. They slowly kill that curiosity and that drive that we have as kids. And after 12 years in school where we don't ask those kinds of questions, and you go to college, if you go to college and you get, it used to be in college you could ask any questions you wanted, because college was a place that was there to challenge what you learned already,
right,
to make you grow mentally. Now college is not much more than the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th grade.
Right.
That you just take in what they want, regurgitate what they want, don't ask too many questions, because if you rock the boat, they'll cancel you out. So when you get further in life, you're like, well, why would I do this? Because if I rock the boat, I'm going to become irrelevant and Molly's going to be really hard. Well, sometimes that hard life is where you learn the most. And like, well, is that really how it has to be? You know, and you know, I try to do that with my own kids. You know, I try not to kill their curiosity, but you know, it can be hard because I also have a lifetime of being taught we don't ask certain questions, we don't ask 1,000 questions, sit there, shut up, and do what I tell you. You know, and it's a hard cycle to break.
No, it really is. It really is. It takes a lot. It takes more than a lot. It takes self-discipline, and it takes, like, you literally need to break down your emotional structure and rebuild yourself emotionally. And it you can't do that. You can't break above the veil without learning emotional intelligence first. Because along the way you're gonna hit traps, pitfalls, and if you're not ready for it, you're gonna think you escaped the mentality, and you're just gonna slowly sink right back into it. Like you'll climb, and be like, all right, I'm good. Like no. You're not. No, you have to keep going. You have to keep going when you don't want to. You have to keep going, and then you don't ever stop. That's the point, is not stopping. You know, because once you stop, the veil just catches up with you, and then you can sink right back down into it, and you just don't stop ever learning about yourself, learning about your about the world around you. There's nothing else. Yeah. We don't have interplanetary, you know, travel, so... Learn yourself, learn the world around you. You know, even with the internet, there's still things out there. Physically seeing it, experiencing it is a whole different world.
Yeah, that absolutely is. You know, people are doing like these like virtual tours of these like museums. Like, oh, I've been here. Like, no, you haven't been. You saw it on a computer screen. It's not the same as seeing it in person. You know, there's no substitute for doing it yourself and seeing it yourself and feeling it yourself. You know, you can read about it all you want and you can learn about it all you want, but until you see it and do it yourself, it's not quite the same thing. And it is very easy to make progress and keep moving every day. And then you're like, all right, well, yeah, I got here. And you plateau because you stop pushing yourself as hard. And then you realize you're slowly falling back into that same old mentality and that same old system. And it takes more work and harder work to get yourself re-going again, because now you feel kind of deflated. You're like, well, I was doing really good, and now I feel like I'm back at square zero. And I mean, you're not there. You already have experience with more knowledge, but it doesn't make it feel like you're not there any less.
Right.
You know? And it can be hard to get yourself moving again, because, you know, it's, was it that Newton's law, a body in motion stays in motion, a body at rest stays at rest.
Right. Like,
you have to keep yourself moving. As long as you're moving, it's easier to keep that momentum going. It's easier to keep learning by yourself while you're learning about yourself. It's easier to keep yourself learning about what you want to learn about if you keep doing it. The moment you stop and you let yourself stop for too long, the harder it is to get back into that, because you lost that momentum. You had to rebuild that momentum, and you had to start from scratch with that momentum again. And that can be the hardest part. That's where the self-discipline comes in. Do you have the discipline to make yourself get up and do what you don't want to do, but you know you need to do for yourself, no matter what's going on? You know, it doesn't matter if you're starting back at zero again or not. You know, if you know that you are better off over here, you know, don't you want to get yourself back there where you're better off, or do you want to just stay where you're at because it's just easier and that's too much work? You know, I'm sorry, I want to be where I'm happier, and I have the discipline enough to see where I want to be happier at and at least make small steps, if not big steps, when I can. You know, and you know, that's, I think, a lot of self-discipline. People think you have to do these giant steps. I'm like, no, like, you can start off with just get up in the morning and doing a quick little 5-minute workout, or like read a book about something you want to learn about for 5 minutes, or take 5 minutes and thinking about, focus on an emotion that you're having trouble dealing with.
You know, I mean,
focus on it. Give yourself those a few minutes. It doesn't have to be an hour. It doesn't have to be hours or days. It can be a few minutes here and there.
Yes, you the know. Small wins.
Yeah.
It always starts with the small wins. Because, I mean, you want to hear about darkness? The first of my small wins was simply brushing my teeth.
Yeah.
You just wake up, and then it's not doing it, it's doing it every day at the same time every day.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes, you know, it can be that difficult. It can be, I'm a little different than the average. However, you know, that's just that. That's a little perspective, because there are millions of people just like me. You know, yeah. Maybe not hundreds of millions, but you know, I could be your son, I could be your brother, I could be whoever. You know,
so. Yeah, no, and that's, you gotta take the small wins. You gotta know what is small for yourself, and that, you know, that's one of the easiest things to overlook. And you know, like brushing your teeth, you're like, well, that's so simple, but yeah, but that's self care. You know, that little bit of self care can change your entire outlook for the rest of your day. Right. You know, and it absolutely takes what, 30 seconds to a minute? Like, and you can't spare 30 seconds to a minute of your life to go do a little bit of self care to change the outlook for your entire day. Yeah. But that little bit can make a huge difference. You know, it's, you know, for me, like, I try to get up in the morning and I try, you know, brush my teeth. And there are times I get my brush teeth like hours after I've been up. I'm like, oh, my teeth are still fuzzy because I got up in the morning, I went to the bathroom, I made my coffee and sat down on the couch and did nothing. And there are other days where I get up in the morning, I go to the bathroom, I brush my teeth, I make my coffee, and I go outside and I do a quick little 10-minute workout. And those days are the days where I feel amazing throughout the rest of the day. And the days where I get up and I just go to the bathroom, make coffee, sit on the couch and watch TV until everyone gets up, I am pretty lethargic all day long and I feel like shit, you know.
Yeah.
But those small little things can make a big difference, just because, like, you know, it changes your perception for the day. Like, all right, I did this.
Right.
You'll feel good about it. When you feel good about it, it's easier to do something else that feels good for you.
And when
so it's, you know, they sound ridiculous, but they really do build up quickly, and you know, they can change your entire outlook. And you know, self-discipline is all about changing your outlook on life as well. There's a video that I sent one of my clients not too long ago. It was actually is Arnold Schwarzenegger talking about why only the 1% really succeed, and he talks about he had a vision and what that vision was, and he didn't listen to anyone else. You know, he grew up in this rural farm town out in Austria, and he's like, I'm gonna be this guy. And he found a guy who he wanted to be like, and he's like, well, this is what I have to do, you know. And he had that self-discipline, and he made these small steps, and didn't matter what anyone said, he'd continue doing it anyway, because he learned early on to just say, fuck off. If you're not there to support me, I don't want to hear what you have to say.
Mm-hmm.
Which is honestly the hardest thing to do in life, is to have that kind of confidence in what you're doing, to be like, fuck off, this is what I'm doing, whether you like it or not. Because, you know, it's human nature, you want to fit in.
Right.
You want to be like the herd. It's hard to stand out, and you know, I have always kind of stood out my whole life anyway. You know, I was raised as a Mormon in an area that's not high in, does not have a high concentration of Mormons. There's a lot of Catholics, a lot of Protestants, and my whole life I've heard about like my beliefs being wrong or backwards. Like as a child, like who as an adult tells a child that their beliefs are backwards when you're, right. They know that you're learning from your parents. You know, most people are raised the way that their parents were raised, and vice, you know, and it's like my whole life I've been the black sheep in society. And it's a hard spot to be. So I understand when people are like, I don't want to do that. You know, I have my own emotions and my own issues with standing out. You know, doing what I'm doing now is a huge jump off a cliff for me, really kind of putting my inner world out there. But yeah, that is the hardest thing about doing anything in self-discipline, is like, you know, telling people like, oh, this is what I'm doing, whether you like it or not, this is what I am doing.
Right.
I don't really care how you feel about it. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that self-discipline comes in that with that too. You know, you have to, with that self-discipline to do what you want to do, you know, you have to also have that mindset and that fortitude to be like, well, whether you like this or not, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing.
Right. Absolutely.
Because, you know, the herd doesn't like to watch people progress. They're like, well,
it really doesn't.
you hear it all the time, like when people who grew up in very poor areas, and I've heard it in my own family, of my own friends, you get someone who grows up in this rundown ghetto area, and they make something with their lives. You know, they get out, and the people that are still there, like, they forgot where they come from. They did not. I assure you, they did not. That is why they're not there. You know, they knew where they were at. They were not happy there. They knew what they needed to do to get out of that situation, and they did it. And they didn't care what you thought about it. You know, but that is hard, because you know you have all those people in your life who want you to be stuck where they're at, because you give them hope, but you also make them depressed because they don't have the self-discipline themselves to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier rough to pull people down than to try to build people up.
It's rough. They'll do, like, I mean, I've had a lot of friends support me, and I'm not talking about them, like, close friends. However, there are people that it's just, you know, like, you can just feel it. You can just tell that they just don't want, they don't care, they don't want you to. I've actually haven't met much resistance in the way of stop doing what you're doing. I've only met indifference, you know, like I would tell people and they were like, oh, well, whatever. You know, there's not really, you know, there's a huge section of the population that aren't into podcasting. They just think the shit is god awfully fucking boring.
Yeah.
So, I mean, when you break it down, you just, especially with something like this, you can't really be too upset. It's just at the same time, it only takes 2 seconds. And when you could just feel it. You could just feel the animosity, the general animosity of the people that you've known for a while, and like they're watching you and I don't want to say they don't want you to. I want to say they're just scared of it. They're just nervous, you know?
Yeah, and they handle by just being dismissive about it.
Right. Because
they don't want to take the time to try and figure out what it is you're doing and understand what you're doing. They're like, oh, well, I don't really care. You know, and that dismissiveness is actually can be more painful than just someone straight up telling you, you shouldn't fucking do this.
Right. Like, I'd rather be like, oh, I shouldn't. Well, I'm gonna make more now.
Yeah. Like, let me show you how I shouldn't do this by doing it more.
Right. I think, yeah. I don't know. But let's see here. No, yeah, it's rough. It's a rough, only because you think to yourself, you're like, well, why wouldn't you? Because I would. And it's because, you know, they don't have the drive, the passion. They're still working at, 78 points to pass. You know what I'm saying? They're still doing 80 points to pass.
Yeah, whatever they determined their bare minimum was, is like, that's what they're doing. Like, well, so it's like, not, I do just fine. Why can't you just do this? Like, is it just easier to go along than to try to change what you're doing?
Yeah, and people just, you know, like they're not going to go above and beyond for themselves, so they're not going to go above and beyond for anyone else. And it's not because they hate you, and it's just because, see, I've always thought the biggest scam was being sold the difference between right and wrong. In my personal view, there isn't really right and wrong. There's just two different mindsets. You know, I mean, there's obvious, you know, there's evil. You know, there's like murderers and rapists and shit, you know?
Yeah.
But as far as right and wrong, I feel like it's a scam. It's a control measure. And I feel like there's just two mindsets instead of two different mindsets. And you can look at it as objectively as you want. And it's odd because the more objective you look at it, the more it pisses people off, because it seems like you're dismissing their feelings when you're just making an objective observation about mindsets. You know what I'm saying? People don't get it.
No, I tell people when they come in, like, well, this is a good experience, this is a bad experience. Like, well, what makes it good or bad? Like, you know, if you think back about what you thought was a really bad experience, but you talk about it, chances are you're going to talk about it while laughing about it, you know, because after the fact, you're like, well, you know, that at the time, that moment really sucked. But, you know, you can look back at it and like, I learned a lot in that moment, though. So that was that moment really a bad moment, or was it a good moment? But it's all about the perception of how you look at it, you know. And, you know, that's how most experiences with life are, most things in life are. Like, it's really about your perception of how you look at it. You know, is it bad? Is it good? And that's, and it varies from person to person and their perception. But that, you know, that's like not everything. Like, well, this is good because these are what society deems as good. Well, yeah, but is that always good? Because there's a lot of things that I wouldn't agree are necessarily good that you guys deem as good. Because the way I look at the world, I'm like, yeah, well, that's not horrible, but I wouldn't consider that great. And you know, it's. You know, that whole idea of good and bad and right and wrong really changes throughout time. You look at human history and you can see where we were okay with certain things and not okay with them then. Now we're okay with certain things that we were not okay with back then, you know, 100 years ago, and vice versa. Like there are things that we do now that are like that's absolute garbage. Why would you do that? You know, and. But again, it's perception. It's like you know, as perception changes, our idea of what's good and bad changes. So what really makes something good or bad besides perception? You know, that's it's everything's just an experience. Everything's just something that happens. And you know, we're the ones who decide if it's good or bad. And it's not, you know, there, like you said, there are inherent things that everyone can agree, these are actual evil. Outside of that, what's evil, good and bad, really is up to the mind of the holder, you know.
Making it effectively making it not a fact, because facts don't change. They're dynamic, they're components. They just don't change. It's information given with objective reality. It just doesn't change. Right and wrong changes. You know, what was right 150 years ago isn't right now. And what's right now isn't going to be right in 150 years from now. So
Yeah. Why are we fighting over
we shouldn't be. We should be more focused on mindsets instead of arguing about these grooves and nooks and crannies of social dynamics and constructs. Anyway, I have questions. More questions, and we kind of dove off in a little side tangent, which is fine.
It happens.
It does. It does. It was gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful piece. However, I am very interested in guided journeys. And
So
tell me a little bit about a guided journey.
guided journey is a lot like a guided meditation. You know, meditations usually you stay in your mind. Guided journeys, we say, like you leave your mind and you leave your body and go out into the spirit world. So those, like you come in, you know, I usually play some Native American flute music or something on a little speaker, something, some kind of music to help set the mood, set the tone, some drumming sometimes, and you know, you quiet the mind, you take a few deep breaths in. I will have us bring up a rainbow light from the earth up to your feet and up to your body. And then you take your solar plexus, you see a fire starting solar plexus, you move it to your heart, let it grow, and then you step through it and you come out into what you see in your mind's eye and any world that you any path that you recognize. And at that point you're taking your spirit, your consciousness, and you're leaving your body and you're going out to explore the energy world, or the spirit world. And you can, you know, go the upper world, the lower world, the middle world. There's different levels. There are different things to experience, different things you can learn while you're out there. But yeah, guided journey is really to kind of take your, you let your, you allow your soul, your spirit to leave your body and go explore in the energy world for information. You know, sometimes it's just for an experience. I have gone to the lower world to find power animals. You can come out to the middle world and you go visit the fairies, the trolls. You go to the upper world where you go to the Akashic Records and the Akashic Temple, and that's where every experience you've ever had in your life, your past life, your future lives, all resides. You can get all the information right there. And then you get to, you know, with that, people start questioning about reincarnation, because you talk about past lives and future lives. I'm like, you know, we're all energy. Energy cannot be can only be transformed. It can't be created or destroyed.
Mm.
And we run off of energy. You know, we are electrical beings. You know, 50 milliamps is enough to stop a human heart, which is next to nothing. That's a very short, a very small electrical charge can stop our heart. You know, we can measure our brain waves outside our body now. They no longer have to put sensors on your head to measure your brain waves and your thoughts. They can now measure outside your body. So we know that we are energy beings. So how hard is it to really believe that if we're energy beings, that when we die, the energy is not being transferred to another life?
Right.
You know, it's a little abstract, but it's not really that abstract. If energy cannot be created or destroyed, only transformed, you know. So when you go to these other places, you're tapping into that same energy, that universal energy that I was talking about with Reiki, you know, that universal energy that everything is made up of. That's where all information is held. And when you go on these journeys, you tap into that energy. You change your vibration depending on what energy, what information you're looking for, and what level you need to be at. Because, you know, our emotions and all that stuff, they're all energy and they're all vibrations. And when you go out into the energy world, you know, you have to change your vibration to match what you're looking for. And that's a lot what the guided journey is. You know, you're going out there and you're constantly raising your vibration enough to leave your body. And then you're raising or lowering your vibration depending on where you want to travel at in the energy world to seek whatever you're looking for.
Wow. I love it.
It's like, yeah, because like with meditation, they'll tell people, like, you know, look at a flame and hold that image of your flame in your head and don't ignore everything else going on around you, ignore mm-hmm. any sensation in your body and stuff. You know, just you're focusing on nothing, essentially. You know, you're focusing on just being you. And the journey is just very much like, no, you're going to go out and you're having an actual experience. We're going out, we're leaving our bodies behind here and having an actual experience.
So it is actually as structured to be able to define lower, middle, and upper worlds, as you said.
Yeah.
So I feel like on some, well, I've been doing it consciously, subconsciously, I'm not entirely sure. I think I've been doing something like this, just not really with any direction, right? So
yeah.
Let me just explain this to you, and you tell me, what world do you think that I'm exploring when I do this? Because I do this on a regular basis. The setup is a little different. I do like how you said the rainbow with the fire, and then you step through it. Mm-hmm. However, that's not really my setup. But when I am walking, I'm walking, say, on cobblestone. There are a lot of lightning bugs, and it's not. The background is undefined. I don't know. Maybe I'm too focused on the floor. However, there's. Mm. I don't know. It's very wooden, woodsy, and I don't really stray off of the path, but I do stray around the path, and I'm on it. And sometimes I can hear my footsteps on the cobblestone, because I like the sound of footsteps on concrete, on stone, on gravel. But this, sometimes I get so lost and I don't even hear the footsteps anymore. And I feel like I'm meditating somewhere else. And then, like, I don't know. I think at those times I fall asleep, I'm just gone at that point.
Yeah, that does happen. One of the best ways to fall asleep is to try meditating, because you'll just fall asleep instead.
Right.
Just let your body relax. Now, I would say you're actually in the middle world. Usually when you come out in the middle world, because the middle world is a world we exist in already. It's just this world in energy form. And then in order to go up or down, you have to find a way to go either down into the earth or up into the heavens. So you're definitely coming out into the middle world, and you're coming out into your little area, whatever spot that may be.
my representation
of it. It
could
be a place that you've actually been to in your life, or it could be a place that you made up in your own world, and that is absolutely valid, you know, because it's you're coming out to a path you know well. You know, if you have the cobblestone because you like the sound of feet on the cobblestone, then that's why you're in that spot, because this is a spot that is comforting and soothing to you. And it may not be so defined to see, because you're not really setting up any expectations of what you want there. You're just like, well, I'm here,
and I don't know what to do anymore.
I don't really have a set, you know, definition of what I want for the rest of this. You know, no expectations, and that, I mean, that is actually very freeing in itself. Just if you kind of journey without any expectations, because then you're open to the experience. You're not looking for any one thing in particular. Like, well, I'm here for whatever happens. You know, whatever happens is going to happen, and I'm here for it. You know, that is one of the ways I usually journey when I'm doing my meditations anymore for myself. I just kind of like, well, whatever is going to happen is going to happen. Just show me what I need to know and just go with it. And that's, yeah, so I would say in the middle world. And the main reason why I do the rainbow light and the flame is to, more for when I come back into my body, to make sure nothing's coming back with me. Because when we go out there, we have to think of it as like a moth to a flame out in the woods in the darkness, right? Like, if you're an energy being and you're putting your energy out there, and then there's all these other energy beings who are looking for someone that they can attach to either talk to or whatever, you're the flame out in the woods at night for all the bugs to come flying at. So that the main reason for doing the flame and the rainbow light is a way of protecting yourself. So when you come back in, nothing that's not supposed to be with you is coming through with you. Because especially when you start doing a lot of this journey work that I've been doing, you know, we're really raising your vibrations. You're really becoming more sensitive, and the more you do it, you know, the more sensitive you become. You are, it's actually really not sensitive. The more aware you become of how sensitive you are, because we can all do this. Every single person that is walking this earth can leave their body and journey. Most of us are unaware of how to do it. You know, some of us are aware of how to do it, but we're all equally as sensitive. It's just a matter of where we put where our awareness is at, and getting used to being able to be aware of that sensitivity. But yeah, like when you do these journeys, like, that's the main reason for doing the flame. You know, you want to make sure you're not bringing anything back with you when you come back into your body.
Interesting. I like that. Yeah, I've been doing that for a while, and I don't know. I don't really have too much knowledge on it. It's just my brother was a lot more. He was a lot more into it. He traveled the world. He was in the Air Force, so he actually went to a bunch of different places and was able to meditate in places where, you know, you wouldn't really be able to get to unless you had some type of clearance.
Mm-hmm.
Before we were talking, you said one of your most popular services is the shamanic healing ceremony. Tell me a little bit about that.
So like, if you were to come in, usually the night before a client comes in, I journey for them. You know, I get the permission to journey on their behalf, because I'm going to go connect with your higher self. So if you're coming in, I'd ask permission to journey on your behalf, and I'd ask for your full name and your first and last name. I don't want to know anything else than that. I don't want to know why you're coming in. I don't really want to know anything more than just the person's name and their permission to journey for them. And then I go into I do my own journey the night before, and I talk to the higher self and their guides, and they show me what to work on. They show me where there's blockages. They show me where there's trauma. They don't always show me or explain to me what the cause is. They just show me where the problem is at, where it's being held at in our energy body. And then when you come in, I would tell you what I got for you, what they showed me, I've had some people get very freaked out because I get some information from them that I would have no way of knowing at all. Things happen with their children, you know, things that they held deep inside that no one else knows. And then I get you on the table, and I do my opening ceremony. You know, I place different stones that I work with that I have on my altar. I pull the blockages out, and I fill everything back in with the universal love and light energy. You know, a lot of it's channeling from the heavens and bring it down to the physical. And it's really, I say I'm not the one doing the work. I kind of step out of my body and I let spirit kind of come in and guide my hands on what to do and where to go. And it's also up to the client who's on the table if they're willing to release whatever needs to be released and being open to the experience. But most people who do come to me come in for the shamanic healing ceremony because that's, I would say, it's most close to what they would expect from any energy worker, because it's not really a whole lot different than what most people can do. They kind of come in, they figure out where your blockages are at, and then they remove their blockages using whatever various tools that that person uses. I happen to use stones, feathers, and plants in my hands. But you know, most people generally feel very relaxed afterwards, and they feel lighter, and they feel like a burden's been pulled off of them. They just, you know, they like they were able to release. And it's really, and I tell them all the time, you know, I'm holding the space, you know, and I'm giving you something physical to work with for you to release your own trauma, your own blockages, you know, because we all have free will. So you can come in here and I can spend an hour or two working on you. But if you're closed off the entire time going, well, this isn't going to work. This is a bunch of horseshit. Well, you're right. Well, that's what you're going to get. You know, it's not going to make a difference because you're not willing to allow it to make a difference. You're already closed off to the experience, you know, and fortunately, you know, I feel like most people who come to me are already open. They're looking for something different. They're looking for an experience. So I generally don't have a problem with people not getting something out of a shamanic healing ceremony with me, because you know they're open to it. But they run from half an hour to an hour and a half. Every person's different because it really depends on what that person needs to be cleared out. I've had a couple people where I've had to tell them to come back because they have more work needs to be done that I then can really be done in that one session without causing a healing crisis, because you can also get a healing crisis during a shamanic healing ceremony. Because, you know, again, it's going to bring up a lot of past traumas, a lot of old emotions, a lot of stuff that we've been trying to bury that we spend years burying. And the work doesn't just stop when you leave my office. You know, the work continues for another 21 days after you leave. You know, because we have seven major chakras in our bodies, you know, starting at the base of your spine, called the root, all the way up to the crown chakra and the top of your head. And the energy that you experience when you come in here will stay 3 days in each chakra and move up and spend 3 days clearing out what needs to get cleared out in that next energy center and slowly work its way up. And so I often tell people, like, when you leave here, you know, for the next 21 days, try to drink a lot of water. If you feel the urge to go for a run, go for a run, because whatever you're going to release when you're running, that's what your body is trying to tell you it needs to do to release whatever it's trying to clear out. You know, if you feel like you need to start drawing, you're like, I never, you know, I don't draw, but I really have the strong urge to draw, because that's what your body wants to do to release whatever it needs to work out. So in a lot of, you know, a lot of times it can open us up to new experiences that and new creative outlets to allow us to self-heal. Because that's, I feel like a lot of what this is it's helping people learn how to self-heal. Because when you know, if you come in for me for a session and after you leave, you have a strong urge to go sit in nature and write poetry. But when you're doing that, like, you can get a lot of emotions that, well, you just found out a new tool for yourself to self-heal, and you won't need to come back and see me again. you know, unless something else happens. But, and that's really what I want. You know, I want people to learn how to self-heal. So when they come in, I want them to figure out how their body responded to the session afterwards, so they don't have to come back in. You know, 'cause I don't want people being dependent on me. I want you to learn how to take care of yourself. You know, I'm just here to help you figure out how to take care of yourself, because you've hit a point where you've gotten too overwhelmed and you feel lost. Well, here are some tools that you're going to learn on your own. You know, I'm going to do some work, but you know, the rest is on you.
Right. Wow. That's a lot. So you said earlier that you experienced some people that really have gotten sick from something, from not.
Yeah. When I first started doing Reiki, I got attuned to Reiki 1, not too long before my best friend, died, and his widow, you know, my ex-girlfriend and I offered to give her a Reiki, and she did, but because she was in a very rough spot, because, you know, she had 3 kids with this guy and had just lost him, she, instead of drinking any water, you know, continued drinking Jack Daniels, and she got very sick. You know, she was sick for 3 days, and she called me up. She's like, "I am never doing what you did to me ever again." Well, you know, last I heard, she is on her own spiritual path, learning different modalities, because despite how traumatic that healing crisis was for her, it didn't turn her off from it completely, because she did start feeling better afterwards. You know, just most people, though, I found have not had too many problems. They'll have a problem somewhere in the 21 weeks, somewhere in the 21 days, where they'll have stuff, they'll have the urge to do something, and they will ignore it, and they might get like a sudden bout of depression for a couple of days, because they're not, you know, they're not working with their body. Their body's trying to tell them what they need to do, or you hit a spot where you're just like, hey, it seems like everything's falling apart around you, because your body's like, hey, listen to me, you know,
right?
I'm trying to do something, and you're ignoring me. That's the most common I've had happen. People just can't, like, they hit like a rough spot for a couple of days where they're not listening to what their body wants. And, but, you know, fortunately, that really has been kind of a minimum. At least I've had minimum feedback on that.
So it's coming out anyway.
Some people are pretty good.
It doesn't matter.
Getting back to me, other people are not.
It doesn't matter if it's, it doesn't matter if you listen to your body or not, it's coming out anyway. It basically is
the effect. It's going to come out one way or another.
Right.
It's gonna, your body has to process it one way or another. And so you're going to do it willingly, or it's going to come out one of your two ends.
Yeah.
it's your choice.
Yeah. Like a bad spiritual hangover.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because when you come in for a session, you're basically saying, like, I am here for this. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once you start the experience, you really can't stop the experience halfway through. Unfortunately, it's not, you're like, you know, I mean, you could actually, you could be like, all right, guys, you know, I thought I was ready for this. I'm really not. And, you know, spirit will listen. But if until you say that, it's going to do with what you signed up for.
Right.
Because, you know, we have free will. We have 100% free will, especially because of energy and the energy we take in, the energy we give out. You know, but spirit only listens when you finally set boundaries. If you don't set boundaries, it's not going to listen. It's like, well, you said you're going to do this, and you didn't tell me to stop, so I'm not going to stop. You've complained, but you haven't said stop.
Right. Right. Fair enough.
Yeah. So it's kind of like one of those, like, you know, you have to, the safety word is, I'm done, guys. Leave me alone.
Right.
But until they hear that, you know, it keeps going.
sounds like a very powerful thing to do. And in a society that basically ignores that part of us, I'm sure and like, as you said, with the woman, the drinker. We live in such a very such a reactionary society that she received You know, she received the session. She got it going. She didn't listen. She did what she wanted to do, and she did. She got very sick from it.
She paid the price.
And then, lashed out at you for it, saying, "You know, I'm never doing this again. You know, this was horrible." And you know.
Yeah, and but it was like the last I heard, because I haven't talked to her in a long time. But last I heard, she has continued down the road. So despite how horrible it wasn't so horrible. It turned her off from it completely. Right. It was just, you know, once she processed what was going on and finished healing more, because, you know, she had a lot of healing to do anyway. There was a lot of grief to go through that's not going to be fixed in just one session or even a couple sessions. You know, that's a lot of personal inside work that has to get done. And it has to be done slowly. It can't be rushed through. But yeah, it's like, you know, it's, you know, part of that process is learning how to listen to your own body and listen to who those who are working with you. You know, it's, I'm not trying to tell you how to live your life. I'm not telling you not to drink, but, you know, for a couple of days there, don't drink. You know,
right.
Give your body a chance to process what just happened. Because it's similar to a massage where your body's going to relax enough while you're on my table. That when your body relaxes, it releases toxins. It can do what your body is meant to do. You know, you can almost hit like that REM stage of sleep while being awake on my table with the way your body relaxes. Mm. And when you hit that, your body just, dude, that's when your body processes all the shit we put in it all day long. You know, it has to come out one or another. And, you know, the preferred way is to drink a lot of water and pee it out.
Mm.
The other ways are, you get diarrhea or you vomit because your body's like, well, there's toxins in me and you're not flushing it out properly or fast enough. So, and I need it out.
Right. Sounds like a rough process if you don't do it correctly.
It can be. Sometimes we need that though. Sometimes people need that rough process to get the actual wake up call.
Right.
Some of us are a lot more stubborn than others. And you know, I'm about as stubborn as they come, so I understand where she was coming from. Like, well, yeah, whatever. I've made it through this part of my life doing everything I wanted to do, so, you know, buzz right off.
Let's see. Such a illustrious service list. I'm not gonna lie. Let's see. Let's dive a little into chakra balancing. That sounds fun.
Yeah. So, chakra balancing, I kind of touched on earlier. Like, we have seven major chakras. You have the root, your sacral, your solar plexus, your heart, your throat, your third eye, and your crown.
Mm.
And those are the major energy points. Now, there are, I don't know how many chakras are exactly on top of my head or how many energy points. There's like 144 or something. There's a lot. But there are seven major ones. And they run from the top of your head down to the base of your spine. And they all have different ties into our lives. You know, the root is your right to be here on this earth, your right to live, your survival. And a lot of us have trauma in our root chakra because, you know, as children, if you don't have the best home life, it can really shatter the way you view the world as being safe and your ability to survive in this world.
Mm.
A lot of rape victims, victims of any kind of abuse as children, even just being like neglected, where like they have trauma in their root chakra because as children, they already had a fight to survive. Their survival was not guaranteed or safe.
Right.
So when you start clearing that up, you know, they feel like they're allowed to be here. Then you go to your sacral chakra, which is like your right to thrive in this world. It's the physical part of this world, the money, your house, your possessions. It's, you know, how abundant you are. And, you know, most of us don't really feel like we have a right to really thrive because we view thriving as being a multimillionaire, not as I have enough to get by and I'm comfortable. You know, that's, in my own opinion, an abundant, thriving life is where you're not you're not really wanting for your basic needs. You know, you have enough money, you have a good house, you have enough food, you have everything you need physically for a decent life. Now, where you view that at depends, you know, very from person to person, but my, in its core, in its most basic form, as far as my belief is concerned, you know, if you have enough money to get what you need, and you have a house to live in, and you have enough food to eat, and you're not constantly worried about how you're going to pay your bills, is there enough money to put food on the table? Then you're, you know, there's not much wrong with your sacral chakra. But, you know, if you're, if you feel like you don't have enough money, and you feel like you don't have enough food to feed your family, you know, that's going to manifest in your sacral chakra. You can clear that out, and it'll clear up a lot of your own mental and emotional ties to those things. And when you clear that out, you actually end up becoming more open and allowing stuff to flow into your life easier. It was kind of like when you don't expect something, or when you if you're always looking for something, the second you stop looking for it, you get it, is the same kind of thing. If you're focused on not having enough money, well, you never have enough money because you're focused on not having enough. When you stop focused on not having enough, and you're like, well, it's going to be what's going to be, you're more open to receiving more money in. And that's the same, you know, that ties into clearing out your root, your sacral chakra. You know, you clear it out and you're opening it up to fresh energy to come in. You're getting rid of the blockages there and the old ties you're holding on to about if you can thrive or not. And then you go to your solar plexus, and that's your, you know, that's your self-confidence. That's your source of power. You know, and a lot of people have very low self-esteem. You know, they fake it very well, but they have very low self-esteem, very poor thoughts about themselves and feelings about themselves. And you know that, and you can see that in the solar plexus chakra. And you know, when I'm working on chakras, I have stones that correspond to the chakras I'll place on the body, and then I'll hold a pendulum over there to help clear the energy out. And I'll, you know, I can, and I'll watch my pendulum swing around as I'm holding over the over their chakra point, and I can see how, like, I can, I try to get where it's all spinning about the same amount, and it feels clear. It doesn't feel like there's anything stuck there, you know. And that can help people feel better because they're opening themselves up to getting rid of those repetitive thoughts and feelings in themselves about their own self-worth or their own self-image. You know, that's all held right there. You know, you clear out, if you have bad self-image, you know, work on your solar plexus chakra. You know, wear yellow, do things to release those same old thought patterns. You know, that will open you up to allowing a better image of yourself come in. You know, then you have your heart chakra, which is like a center chakra. There's seven chakras. It's number four. It's, you know, there's three below and three above. You know, your heart is where you put yourself out into the world. That is, you know, that's we, you know, the world is love. You know, how we respond is either love or hate. And, you know, the more love you have for the world, the happier the world seems. The more hate you have for the world, the more miserable your world is. And that's all stems in your heart chakra. You know, if there's a lot of anger and misery and hate, your heart chakra is either closed off or it's very dark and murky. If you're full of love, you can actually, you can be too open and too loving with your heart chakra, and you actually put too much of yourself out there, and you can get drained as from that as well, because you're putting too much out there. You're giving off too much of yourself. Then you have your throat chakra. That's your, you know, your throat is your voice, is your right to speak your truth, whatever that truth may be. And I always say the throat chakra and your solar plexus chakra are kind of tied hand in hand, because the more confident you are, the easier it is to speak your truth. And the easier you can speak the truth, the more confident you feel about yourself, because you're going to feel better about yourself, because you're not afraid to say what you have to say, you know. And you can have a throat chakra that's too closed off. People are very quiet, never say a word, they're very shy, generally have a very small or dark, murky throat chakra and a solar plexus chakra. The people who never seem to ever stop talking, no matter what, their throat chakra is probably too active and needs to get dialed in a little bit. Then you have the third eye chakra, which is, you know, it's how you see the world, not just energetically, but also physically. It's how you perceive everything. And the more open your third eye chakra is, like you, the more likely you are to see things that may not just manifest in the physical. You're more sensitive, you know, it's part of your intuition a little bit. Like your top two, your third eye and your crown chakra are all about your intuition. The third eye is about what you can see in this physical world energetically as well. You can close your eyes and what you can still see when your eyes are closed and you look around the room, that's your third eye. That's, you know, you can, that can be too closed off where you just, you're like, well, the physical world is the physical world and that's all there is to it. And then if you're a little more open and your third eye is open and clear, you will see the connection between the world and the connection of things. And when you go on meditation and journeys, it's easier to see with your mind's eye what you're experiencing. And then your crown chakra, then that's your connection to the heavens, to the, you know, to source, to God, whatever it is that you want to call it. You know, that is your connection to your full intuition. And you know, the more intuitive someone is, usually the more open that is. If someone who's like, well, they believe that we're here by accident, there's, and everything's a coincidence and there's only luck or bad luck, and that, you know, the world is what the world is and there's nothing to explain, like you're born, you die, and that's it. Well, their crown chakra is probably very closed off or very murky. Because as you're looking around the world, and you know, the way I look around the world is I see the connections and everything, and I don't, to me, there are no coincidences. You know, everything happens for a reason. We may not understand the reason, but everything happens for a reason. And so that's, and that's how I view the world, and that's how I view the, with my crown chakra. I'm like, well, this is, I'm open to all information because I can see the connection between me and the physical world and the physical world around me. And I pull information in from nowhere, and that's all coming in through my crown chakra. So when you balance them, you know, I have you on the table, and I go through the different chakras with stones I place on there, and then I, the pendulum, kind of clear everything out. And then I usually use Reiki at the end anyway to just kind of help clear and smooth everything out. But you want to get everything as open, everything be open the same amount, and spinning the correct way, and get rid of any blockages in there, because they're, you know, it's all stuff that inhibits us. It's, you know, it's old thoughts, it's old feelings, it's old ways of looking at the world, it's old habits of speaking badly about ourselves. You know, it's old habits about thinking badly about ourselves, and it's old habits about, you know, I'm not allowed to have anything. Everything in the United States gets taken away from me. I'm not allowed to have any of this stuff. You know, I'm not allowed to be here. I shouldn't be here. Why am I even alive? You know, that's all, that stuff comes from blocked and murky chakras. So when you balance them all out, you can change that whole perception that people have, and it can change almost instantly. You can get someone on the table. You do a chakra balancing, it takes about 20 minutes or so, and you know, 20 minutes later, you're meeting a new person.
Wow.
You know, they just release a lot, they let go of a lot, and they're more open to a better perspective of things. You a lot of people don't realize like how much those chakras can really affect our lives until they start learning what they are and how they, what roles they play in our lives, and how they, you know, you can look at someone and they'll tell you some problems, and then you scan their chakras and you're like, oh yeah, right here, you know, and they'll look at it for a minute like, oh yeah, I guess I know where that, why that came up, you know. And yeah, I mean, it's something that's very simple that can make a profound impact for the day or for the week, you know, because you know, you go through the day, at some point you're gonna take some shit in that's gonna clog something else up, or you know, bring in some murkiness, and you know, it's just, it happens. I don't care who you are, you're not gonna go through the day unscathed no
Right.
matter what.
Yeah. Not around here, at least.
Yeah, yeah, not in Jersey. It's you have to be tough in Jersey.
You need divine spiritual armor, my friend.
You do. It's this. I moved here when I was 9 years old, and I was not ready for what I was walking into. And I had a very rough time for the first few years I was living here. And you know, 30 years later, I can say, proudly say, I can handle New Jersey with the best of them. But you know, when I was 9 years old, that was not the case. I was in for a major culture shock.
Yeah, I didn't know. I was born and bred here, so I don't know. I'm just...
Now, I was born out in Western Pennsylvania, which are some of the friendliest people you'll ever meet in your life. And then I moved to North Carolina for a couple of years, where they are friendly to your face. Outside of that, you have no idea what's being said, because they will very much speak nasty about you, but be very nice to your face and not know it. The one thing I'll say about Jersey is you know where you stand. There is no question if someone likes you or not.
Right.
Which is a blessing and a curse. You know, it's nice because you're not wasting your time with someone who doesn't give two shits about you, but it can be rough if you're not expecting to get cut in half by someone just for looking at them.
Yeah, no, it's... Yeah. That and the communication processes that we've developed here in New Jersey are rough.
Yeah. It's very rough. It's very much a teasing process. It's kind of weird when you're not used to that. You're like, well, they just made fun of me. Like, well, that guy's your best friend, and he made fun of you because he's your best friend,
right?
Not because he hates you,
right?
You know, it's very different, but. I can say I enjoy it now because that's now my sense of humor very much.
Yeah, it's an acquired taste for sure.
It definitely is.
But I actually have a number of friends in Pittsburgh, and they are some of the coolest people and funniest people I've ever met.
Yeah, I mean, they will go out of their way to help you out. But, you know, that goes with that whole lifestyle, like, out in that part of the country. Especially when you get out, like, just a little outside of Pittsburgh itself, and you get more into the mountains. You know, those people, they get some very rough winters and stuff. Like, you depend on the people in your town to help everyone else survive. You know, they get rain 300 days out of the year, or, like, cloudy days 300 days out of the year. In the wintertime, it snows. You know, they can get very heavy snowfall in parts of the mountains there, depending on how the storms track through the mountains and the valleys and stuff. So there are spots that can get closed off relatively quickly in a snowstorm with not much snow, because the mountain roads there are so steep. Most people don't realize that the Appalachian Mountains in their peak were taller than the Himalayas, you know, when they formed 400 million years ago. These are old mountains that have worn down over 400 million years, but the peaks and the grades of the roads and stuff are steeper than they are in the Rockies. You know, they may not be tall mountains, but they are very steep mountains, and that makes them very treacherous in the winter months. So the people there have to be very close-knit and very much in a community mindset, which makes them much friendlier than we are here, because we don't have to be in a community mindset here. You know, it snows here and you can be out 10 minutes later, no matter how much snow's on the road, you know, it doesn't make a difference.
Right.
We're on flat ground, you know. it can be 10 feet of snow out there, and the road's somewhat clear, you can get to the store. It's not a big deal. You know, out there, you get 5 inches of snow, and you're going down 9% grade. Well, I don't care if you have a four-wheel drive vehicle or not, with chains on the tires, you're not going anywhere.
Right. Right. Yeah, so I also have a number of friends in Arkansas. Very similar stories. Actually this past winter, they had a really, really bad snowstorm, and they were stuck inside for a good week and a half. And people came from in town, you know, when you live like an hour from town, in town is like something special. So people came from in town with supplies to help the farmers and everyone out on the outskirts of the county. And it was awesome. And nobody was wearing masks. So
that's a very different mindset. And they don't care about that kind of stuff. They're like, no, we need to survive. You know, it's actual survival out here. You have to be self-sufficient to a certain extent. You know, we don't care about these societal standards or whatever people want. You know, I'm sorry, if I'm stuck in my house for a week and a half in New Jersey, I barely have a week and a half worth of food in my house, because I've never been stuck in my house for more than 20 hours.
Right.
You know, no matter how bad the weather's been outside.
Yeah.
Unless there's power outage. And even then, you know, it was 7 years ago, we had the vertical windstorms and power was out for a couple of days. Well, that was only in spotted areas. I could drive half an hour away and find someone that had power and get food. It's not a big deal. Right. I'm not going to be stuck in my house for a week and a half with nowhere to go. So it's just a very different, whole different mindset out there. And to me, it's a much nicer mindset, because they are communal based.
Yes.
they have to be self-sufficient, but they also depend on each other for that self-sufficiency, so to speak.
Yeah, they're also not
They take
geared
care of each
for
other.
it. Arkansas is not geared for something like a heavy snowstorm, 3-4 feet of snow. They're not. They've never, just like Texas, when they got the ice storms and the snowstorms. That's why I hit them so hard. They've never experienced anything like that within the last however many 100 years or whatever. So
No,
there's,
that is the once a century storm for them. That's not the norm.
right. So and then so they're just not used to it. And so when you have, you're not gonna have someone that's like, oh, he's got a Trump flag on his lawn. Skip his house. We're skipping his house. That's not gonna happen. In Jersey, that may happen.
No, Andrew, that definitely does happen. I don't have a Trump flag outside my house. I have a Do Not Tread on Me flag outside my house, and people walk by my house and stare at it. I'm like, that flag does not affiliate me with any kind of political party. It just says, leave me be. My rights are my rights. That's all that flag stands for, as far as I'm concerned. But, people here look at that as like, oh, that means you're a Trump supporter. You can't deem that off of that flag. I'm sorry. But people will look right by my house. They won't even, they'll see us on the porch and they'll look right by because they see that Do Not Tread on Me flag. And they're like, nope, fuck you. You're one of those crazy conspiracy theorists. No, I just want to be left alone. That's what it comes down to.
Look,
But,
it's working.
out there, those people don't care. They don't care about your political beliefs because, you're a neighbor. You need help. They're there to help you, regardless of what you believe. They don't care if you go to their same church or not. They're there to be good people and to help you out because that is what people need to do.
Definitely a way different mindset out and I did a little research on what our area was like, say, 500 years ago. The entire United States and Canada and the most of it was groups of people all practicing shamanic practices. They're all shamanic practitioners, and they were probably some of the most healthiest, resourceful people ever. We call them Native Americans. There are a number of other names and labels, whatever you want to call them. However, one of the stories was one of the coolest stories I've ever read about what we call the Hudson River. Way back when, there was a Viking ship that, or there was a number of Viking ships that actually discovered America or this land before anyone else did, before Amerigo Vespucci, before Christopher Columbus, before all of these other people. But none of them made it out alive because they all, what Vikings wore was basically war gear. So the Native Americans saw that as a threat and slaughtered them. They killed them because they looked like demons that came from the ocean. They just looked like demons. That's why they killed them and then left them there. And then that's why they accepted the pilgrims, because the pilgrims didn't have war gear on. They looked very different.
They
But
didn't pose as a threat when they came off their ships.
right, they didn't, have horns and demon faces and fur all over them.
Carrying their battle axes and their shields.
Right. And however, civil the Vikings were, they just didn't look it. So that was probably, but that's just one of the cool stories I found when I was researching it, because I mean, like, who knows how long they've been doing this? 1,000, 2,000, 4,000 years, they didn't have any written, they didn't write anything down. They passed, their stories were generational. They spoke of their stories.
Yeah, they all had it was all orators. I had people who told the stories, and they learned the stories a whole life, and then they share them that was her role in that community, was to share the stories of their history. You know, you had a question about something that happened, you go talk to Joe, because Joe is the guy who knows all of our history, because he spent his whole life learning history from the elders before him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's how it's all passed down. And you know, who knows how much history has been lost from that, but also who knows how much stories have changed, because the same issue you have is, you know, pass a message down the line with the monkeys. You know, one person says it, by the time it gets 10 people down, the message is very different.
Right.
You know, it's changed a lot. But regardless, you know, there's, and that's probably where a lot of these, the folklore stuff comes from. Like, how much of it is based on fact versus was lost, and how much was embellished, we'll never know. But there's a lot of history there that's been lost just from that stopping, you know, because it's, that form of history telling is much more captivating than reading it in a book. You know, listening to someone tell a story and just sit around the fire listening to this story and being drawn in and captivated, because that's what those people were. They were performers. You know, they were entertainers, and that was their entertainment, was listening to these long stories being told around these big fires and these ceremonies, and that's how they learned their own history. But that's a beautiful way to learn history, and it's much more captivating than it's sitting in a classroom listening to one guy talk in the most boring monotone voice.
Right.
Like Ben Stein, just sitting there like, all right, Jesus Christ, I can't keep my eyes open. This guy's jumping around a fire, dancing and, you know, yelling. There's drums going in the background. You're going to be very much involved and in tune and listening to that.
Would you rather listen to your professor or learn from Rafiki, is your question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Of course you'd want to learn from Rafiki. There's no, you know, there's no way.
Yeah, absolutely. Hands down, much more interesting, much more entertaining.
Yes. Yes, Rafiki was always my favorite in The Lion King.
Mm-hmm.
He was him and Zazu. Both characters were my favorite, while everyone else's favorite was, you know, Simba, Mufasa, blah, 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 Scar. I'm like, yo, let me talk to Zazu. He's he's hilarious. I was reading a little more into this, the activations, and I really like, I don't know, I've heard a lot of other people speak about activations. I was in contact with a couple witches. I spoke to a couple, I forget exactly. I don't even want to fuck it up, just in case they're listening. I don't even know what to call them. So, but they spoke of activations as well. They were like witches. They're like witches, not exactly a witch, something like it.
Somewhere in the Wiccan category.
Yeah, something. And I had an activated stone for a very long time, and I didn't know, actually lost it when I moved. It was odd how I lost it. It was just weird, but whatever. But it was just, it was an activated stone. I had it for a long time, and I didn't know exactly what it was doing or what it did. I just kept it.
Mm-hmm. So it's funny, because it probably misplaced itself. When stones no longer feel like they're needed, or they've taken too much, they will just go missing on their own. They will break. They'll just disappear. Happens all the time. But yeah, the activations, you just take a stone. It doesn't have to be a stone. It can even be like your keys or something. Like, you can take something that you're going to carry with you. And if, you know, if you're someone who has anxiety, you need something to help calm you down. Like, we can take a stone and we'll hold a ritual for it to activate it to help calm you down when you're having an anxious moment. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be anything that, you know, there are stones that already help anxiety, but it doesn't have to be one of the stones. It can be anything. You can go pick up a rock in the driveway and be like, activate this for me for anxiety, and I can activate it for you for anxiety.
Mm.
You know, basically tell the stone that we want to use it to help calm someone down. You know, whatever the object is, doesn't have to be a stone. It can really be like a car key, like, or your ring. Like, if you're married, you can take your ring, you can activate it to help you feel more love or be more open and receptive to love. And it's a very simple ritual and ceremony to activate a stone, but it's a very powerful one, and it's also very subtle. And that's, you know, the activation of the stones when they work, they're not right in your face. Like, it's a very subtle feeling that kind of comes in and just slowly builds. Like, you get around this room, you get around this stone, like, all right, I just feel, as I'm sitting here, I'm slowly getting calmer, my mind slowly clearing, and that is that stone doing its work. If it's working properly, you'll never know it's actually working until you walk away from it. But the activations are they're actually something that's not requested a lot, because I don't think a lot of people fully understand what activating a stone is, or how it can actually help them with their lives and with the things they feel like they need help with. Because you can activate to help with depression, help, boost your mood. You can activate it to help give you confidence, to help give you motivation, like help you focus. You know, it can really be anything that you feel like you need help with. It doesn't always have to be, oh, I want to feel calm, or I want to feel at peace. It can be, I need to focus, and I need something to help me focus. All right, we'll activate this stone. Keep it on you or near you, and when you're near it, it'll help you focus. So you don't always have to hold it. You can place it on your work table or your desk or in the room you're sitting in. Because stones are, they vibrate themselves. At an atomic level, they also are moving. They move at a slower rate, but that vibration they give off still affects us. And then you can ask the energy, just like you can with anything else, like, hey, I want to use you for this. And that's what an activation does. You hold a little ritual ceremony and you're like, well, we want to use you for this. And we ask you permission to allow us to use you for this. And then we perform the ceremony and we activate for that. And we blow the intention into the stone and lock it in there. And then you now have an activated stone to help you with whatever it is that you're looking for help. Whatever it is that you want,
It was a very interesting ritual. I watched it. She used a lot of different tuning forks and chimes and such. And I feel like that's probably why, because as you said, on an atomic level, it's vibrating. And I suppose to activate it in her way, ritualistic way, was to speak to it on a vibrational level.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you say that, because I lost this stone when I moved from I moved from Ocean County to Warren County, and that was a very bad thing for me to do, and I spiraled mentally in Warren County, and I left. I hit rock bottom, like hard. And then found a trap door and fell through that trap door. I hit it hard. And so I moved to Florida with my friend. And that was also another bad move. So out of the skin of my teeth, I made it back to Jersey in Ocean County. And I lost it from the Warren County to Florida trip. And I really feel like it almost saved my life in a way, in addition to a lot of other things, because I was very low. I was low enough to, I don't want to speak too deeply on it, but I was at the point, I was there. We were close. close. In addition to a lot of other things, that stone was there. And I feel like that helped, so.
Yeah, no. They absorb a lot from us. We don't even realize how much we give off when we're in these, when we're feeling anything. But the stronger the feeling is, how much that we're actually giving off to the room around us, and that's what those stones help, because they absorb that from us. And that's, we're asking them to take that burden off of us when we feel it, and take it into themselves. And if we're not clearing them, they will. crack or disappear, you know. And sometimes you can clear a stone to help it keep doing its work a thousand times, but you know, there hits a point where it might be like, I'm out, I'm done, you know, I've served my purpose, and it literally disappears.
Yeah.
Or you know, my wife would wear hematite rings and they would just crack off of her finger. You know, they're just, it would just break. And hematite is an iron ore. It's not something that, you know, it's as much of a metal as it is an actual rock, and, you know, shouldn't break that easily. But, you know, she would be standing at work, and she worked at the time as a pharmacy technician. So she wasn't doing any kind of rough work, you know, opening bottles and counting pills.
Right.
And the stone just, like, the ring just cracked off of her hand. Because it absorbed as much as it could possibly absorb, and it was done. You know, it served its purpose. It was on, off to something else, and that was it. And it does happen all the time. You know, that's, I don't know a single person who does this kind of work that I do that doesn't have a story of one of their stones just going missing and then turning up years later. Like, I've moved 14 times. I didn't pack it up, and here it is. Like, you know, they really kind of come and go. It's almost like they have a mind of their own, which is, you know, in today's world, it's like, psh, you're crazy, but you know, it happens.
No, it's hard. It's hard trying to speak to anybody that, I don't know, isn't involved. You know, that doesn't know.
They're not open enough.
Right. Right. It's just difficult. Like anybody that has, you know, if you want to go on a simplistic level, you can talk to somebody about a show that they really don't like, and you can sit there and tell them how much you love this show, and it's going to drive them fucking nuts. But in your mind, yeah, you're like, you know, I'm telling you, this is genuine self-expression, you know, at its core level, that's what it is. And, you know, you're just being ignored, and it's not their fault. That's just a response based off of the conditioning we've received. So, I mean, in that capacity, it's just difficult to like walk up to someone and be like, hey man, where's your activated stone? You know? So
you don't have one of these?
Right. What are you doing? Like, this was trending last night. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Oh man. No, it's difficult. No, absolutely. And one of the last things that was very, very interesting was the soul splintering.
And yeah, soul retrieval is very, it's very much out there for most. And most people don't really understand what it is. And I was just talking about this with someone a couple of nights ago. You know, in psychology, they call it dissociation.
Mm.
So you can think of it as very something similar. Like, you have a traumatic experience, and part of you splinters off to save the rest of yourself from that trauma. You know, so with soul retrieval, you know, if you are, let's say, a really bad accident that, like, let's say you like lose an arm, right? That's traumatic. Losing an arm is traumatic. I don't care who you are. Like, it's, you know, and part of your body, part of your soul is going to leave, you know, when that happens. It's, that's a very traumatic thing. And like, in order to save the rest of your psyche and the rest of yourself, that piece leaves. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time you have a traumatic experience, at some point you kind of get yourself back together. Cause I mean, like, with someone, like when you lose someone, you know, you don't feel the same. You feel like you lost part of yourself. And when you have a traumatic experience, you feel like there's a part of you that's missing. Something's not, you don't feel like yourself anymore. You feel different. You know, like maybe you have less joy, or maybe there's a piece of your personality that's just not there anymore. And that comes from that, you know, that's part of your soul that left. That's part of your psyche that broke off to save the rest of yourself from any more damage. So with the soul retrieval, like we would, it's a lot of work on my end, because it takes hours to get prepared, and actually days, because I had to do a bit of a fasting for a few days before the soul retrieval, because I had to get myself in a spot to really be able to journey out there far and really raise my vibrations. I have to make my body as light as possible as I can to make it easier for my soul to let go of my body to really kind of journey out there. But you know, when I do a soul retrieval, like they will show me the actual experience that happened that caused that piece to leave. So in that sense, I get much more information about your life. And it's usually just enough that when I tell you what that piece came back from, that you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, they may not go into every gory detail about the traumatic experience, but they will give me enough. I'm like, this age, this happened. You're like, yep. Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then like when you bring it back into your body, you know, I will bring the pieces back. Usually it's no more than six at a time. It's 3 to 6, soul parts come back in a normal soul retrieval session. And, you know, I myself use a piece of pyrite to hold all pieces in, and I keep it wrapped up in a special cloth and a special box that is protected in my office. And when you come in, you know, I will clear your body energetically, make sure you're as clear as possible, because we want to make sure you're in as good of a state as you can be for these parts to come back. And then I will blow them back into your body where I'm guided to. And then, you know, for the next several months, you yourself have homework to do. You have to welcome these parts back, you know, tell them how glad you are to have them back, how much you love them, how much you very much enjoy them being part of you again. And you have to reincorporate these parts of yourself back into yourself. Because if not, like, because essentially, like, if you're an abuse victim, you know, you part of your psyche and part of your soul leaves to protect the rest of it from the abuse, it may not know it's safe to come back. And if you come back, if you bring it back into your body and you are just as dismissive about it as you were before you came in for the session, well, that part's gonna leave again because it doesn't feel safe and welcomed. You know, it's really no different than bringing someone into your house that's been there before but you haven't talked to in years. You bring them in and then you ignore them. They're sitting in the corner going, all right, gee, why the fuck did I come back here? I'm not, you know, I'm better off sitting outside like I was before.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thought and same kind of process. You have to bring them in, welcome them in, make them feel incorporated, and, you know, slowly bring them back into yourself. You know, on a spiritual level for the person, it can be very life changing. They can, you know, they can feel like they had a piece of themselves that they haven't touched, who they haven't been in contact with in years, like an old personality part, like an old humor that they miss, that they wish they could get back to. And you're giving them a way to bring it back into their lives. Usually with that, like they need to have someone with them when they come in, because it can be very emotional and they may not be able to drive themselves when they leave my office afterwards, because they might be too emotional, or they might just be drained. Because like me, you also need to not eat very heavy stuff. Like, you know, if you're coming in that day, we try to tell you that, you know, I try to get you to come in late morning or afternoon because I want you to fast or maybe only have soup or something very light for their work, because, you know, you're also going to be raising your vibration when you're on my table to bring these parts back in. And the lighter you are, the easier it is for me to do my work. You know, afterwards, we tell people, go get a heavy meal. You know, you want to bring yourself back into your body hard. You know, go get a heavy meal. Go have a good talk. But then you need someone to talk to. So we call it your warrior buddy. It's the person that when you're going through these emotions, they're going to come back up, because when you bring these parts back in, the old emotions are going to come back. You know, there's, you know, when you're coming for a healing ceremony, the emotions may come back up. When you come in for a soul retrieval, they are going to come back up. There is no if, and it's when they come back up, how are you going to deal with it? And you need to deal with it in a healthier way than you did before. You know, you need to have someone you can call at any point in time. If it's at 2 o'clock in the morning, if you wake up from a bad dream, you need to be able to call that person if you really feel like you need to talk to someone, to talk to them about it. And that person needs to be ready and willing to work with you as well, which a lot of people have trouble with these days, because most people don't want to be on call for anyone. They don't really want to be there for anyone. But, you know, we all have someone we can really turn to if we need to. But for the soul retrieval, it's really important that they have that extra person there to get a hold of someone who that they know they can talk to that's not going to pass any judgment on them because they're already going through a tough enough time trying to bring this heart back. You know, I've done this for my wife, and this for a few clients who've had sexual abuse, you know, and people who've been sexually abused have a very tough time opening up to people about what they went through. And it's not something that's really easy to talk about because it's the most intimate of moments being vandalized by someone else, you know, and most people get very uncomfortable when it comes to talking about that kind of stuff. You know, who wants to sit there and listen to someone talk about their abuse? You know, it can be rough. It can make you uncomfortable hearing the stories, hearing what happened, and it's up to the person how much they want to share with the other one. But you know, they need someone they can talk to about that they know is not going to judge them, that they know is going to willingly sit there and listen to them and allow them to bare their soul to them.
Right.
But you know, that is part of the soul retrieval. You need to have someone there for that because these things are going to come back up. The emotions are going to come back up. You know, but it's also going to come up in a way that's going to be, again, going to be easier for you to deal with because it's not going to come up like it just happened, but it is going to come up and it's going to happen. It's going to get progressively louder and louder until you confront it or it's going to leave. You know, and part of the reason why the soul retrieval, you know, is my most expensive options because you need to be serious about it. You know, it's not something to be taken lightly. You know, it's a lot of work on my part, and it's a lot more work on your part that you have to be ready and willing to do. You know, you have to be ready to face the darkest parts of yourself in the eye and with open arms and bring it back into you. You know, it's not easy work. You know, I wish it was easy work because if it was easy work, I could heal everyone. But right. You know, you know, most people don't really want to be healed. They spent so much time being this hurt person that they now identify as this hurt person. They don't identify as a healthy, healed person.
Yeah. It also pays to be negative as well.
Yeah.
You get a lot of attention that way. And as a healed person, you can get a lot of attention because you're healed. You just have to bring a lot of negativity into it. You're like, well, I came from this. Remember?
Yeah.
You know, so like,
yeah. you can't just be like, yeah, this is who I am. Like, I have to go through the entire experience and I have to relive my own experience. But, you know, the hope is that when you go through this, you can release the emotions with it. You know, you always hear that saying, remember the lesson, release the emotions. And that's the same thing with this. You know, remember what happened, but you don't have to carry on the emotional burden that comes with it. The emotional burden is way worse than the actual experiences, you know. And learning to let go of the emotions and release the emotions that come with it is really what you're trying to do. You know, you have trauma, you have the emotions, you haven't gone through the emotional baggage to clear it out. And when you come for a soul retrieval, we are kind of forcing you to deal with that emotional baggage. You're basically, you're doing this, you're signing up to deal with, you know, you're basically going to go into like an intense therapy session with yourself. You know, it's, you know, for when shamans do the initiation, now I didn't do this because I'm not an old school shaman and like they are down in South America, but you know, they'll bury you alive. They'll give you a straw and they'll bury you alive for 24 hours to force you to deal with your darkest, deepest selves. No matter what, like it's forced upon you. How can you help someone go through the darkness if you haven't gone through the darkness yourself?
Wow.
You know, and I would say my life, despite me not doing the initiation, my life threw that at me, whether I was willing, ready for it or not. You know, when I lost my brother, that to me felt like my darkest, deepest spot I had to face. You know, it's been 2.5 years and it's still very much an emotional wreck for me. But I've had to face that and I've had to keep living my life and I've had to bring myself out of that. You know, there's no one there that could help me get through that except for myself. You know, I've talked to people, I've gone to grief counseling and, you know, they gave me some tools, but you know, when it came down to it, I basically had to do, you know, I didn't do a soul retrieval for myself, but you know, that did come across my mind to get a hold of my own shaman, to do a soul retrieval for myself because like I'm at this point where I feel like I need something more than I can do for myself. But you know, doing the training that I've had and gone through, like I was able to call back what I needed to call back for myself. I am very much an independent person. I'm not good at asking for help from anyone. my wife drives, like, it drives us all the time because I refuse to ask for help. You know, it's just very much who I am. But, you know, the soul retreat will help with that. You know, so you don't have to try to bear this on your own. You can, you're asking for help. You're reaching out to the community.
Right.
You're making your own little tribe, you know, between the shaman and your warrior buddy. And it may not be just one. It might be two. It might be three. Like, whatever, whoever you need to build around you for this intense healing, because it is going to be intense healing, you know. And it can take weeks, months, or even years, depending on how far you're willing to take it and how intense you're willing to dive into it, you know. But I'm hoping if they're coming in for a soul retrieval, that they are ready to do the work. They know that there's a piece of them that's missing that they need to bring back.
Mm.
And that, you know, it's not just as simple as coming on my table and laying my table and you're done. No, like, it takes work. Like, you have to put the work into it yourself to get what you want out of it. I'm just giving you something tangible to work with, and I'm helping clear the way as much as I can to make this easier for you.
Yeah, it all cycles back. It all and always forever will cycle back to, we have a serious and severe lack of motivation, self-discipline, self-awareness, and emotional intelligence in our society.
We do. Well, they offer a magic pill for everything, right? Like, you need weight loss? Don't change your diet. Don't change your lifestyle. Go buy this little magic pill.
Right.
And keep living the way you're living, and that pill will help you lose weight. Well, right. That's horseshit. We all know it doesn't work. But we still buy into the model every day.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's easy, it's comfortable, it's convenient, mm-hmm. it's everything, it's C, it's average, it's all right, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I there's no more dangerous position to be in than to be in the path of someone that's on their way to waste their fucking time. There's no dangerous place, yeah. More dangerous place to be in. Like,
no, they'll drag you right down with them.
Yes, they will fucking kill you. They will run you over. They will take you with, it's, you know, and, but you know, you tell them or try and speak with them on a realistic level, on a healing and a holistic level, and they will almost laugh at you. And
yeah.
to live in a society like that, you know, how is that even remotely even conducive for any type of creativity, any type of, you know, healing, or any type of, like, peace? Like, we're all you need to do is take one drive down Route 70 in New Jersey to find out that every single person has severe anxiety.
Yeah.
Severe anxiety. If you're not really anxious to get to wherever you're going, you're really anxious to be there. Right?
Yeah.
So with that whole formula, you have crazy people and slow people. And it's very driving is always my point of reference for human communication, because that is a high tense, high stress situation where we have very limited communication. And you can see that it doesn't matter if we have very limited communication, because they're going to do whatever they want to do, whether it's not courteous, dangerous or safe or whatever, you know.
Yep.
I want to see I want to see someone drive safely and effectively at the same time. It takes self-discipline, it takes self-awareness, and it takes emotional intelligence. And there's actually a smaller number of people that drive safely and effectively. Not just safely, because if you drive too safely, you're actually becoming dangerous.
Yeah, you become a hindrance to everyone else.
Right. You become dangerous. So you have to drive safely and effectively. There's two. It's a two-part. Safely, comma.
I was living up in North Jersey for a while, and I worked for an outdoor store, and I was driving their box truck to run deliveries between stores. And when I was leaving, I was training this 21-year-old kid how to drive this box truck, which was just under needing a CDL and needing air brakes. And we're in Bergen County, you know, and driving through one of the most popular parts of New Jersey with the most amount of traffic. And I looked at him and I was like, you have to be a defensive, aggressive driver. I was like, what? I'm like, you have to be aggressive where you put your nose out there, but you have to be defensive because you have to watch what everyone else is doing because they don't want you in there.
Right.
Like, it's the worst, most nerve-wracking way to drive, but that's very good, like, analogy for life, though, because, like, you only have control of your vehicle. You can't control anyone else on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's up to you to keep yourself safe. You can't depend on anyone else on the road to do it. Like, you just have to watch out for them, make the best moves you can make while keeping yourself safe and also keeping yourself out of harm's way, keeping someone else out of harm's way. But most people, when you drive down the road, I can't tell you how many people I see on their phones, and I ride a motorcycle 90% of the time. I'm on the road, you know, winter time, rain, doesn't matter, I'm on my motorcycle. And I watch people just sit there on their phones, driving down the road, not even looking at the road, texting the entire time. Like, oh, come on. Like, do you realize that you're in a 5,000-pound weapon? Like,
right.
Do you guys worry about guns? But that car can do more damage than a gun can to more people,
right,
in just the same amount of time. Because if you're not paying attention, you can take out a tree or a telephone pole that can take out other people and other things that you don't know about. You know, you can hit someone without even realizing it because someone was out in front of you. You don't have the time to look up from your phone and stop. You mm-hmm. don't have the reaction if you're not paying attention, you know. And like, it's people get in their car and they feel like their own little world, and like, it's, you know, well, I'm in my car, it doesn't matter what's going on around me. But it does matter what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to be responsible for what you're doing in that vehicle.
Right.
Requires,
you know, focus.
It's not just you out there. Right. Despite what you might think.
Yeah, imagine that. It requires focus. That,
yeah.
Like, you could just tell. We have a problem. Everyone in New Jersey suffers from some type of mental illness. A good 85, 89% of us do. And
yeah.
We're just not willing to address it. And it's okay because we're allowed to have this mental illness, stay in a C mindset and get away with it because it's not detrimenting their life, their money. You know what I'm saying? So, like,
yeah,
it's okay to be slightly, you know, anxious all the time. But when you hop in a car, you're fucking going 80 miles. You know, I always say it. I say Route 70 is the route, not the speed limit.
No,
it drives me nuts.
I am guilty of doing 70 plus on Route 70 many times. You know, my friend's parents have a house out in LBI, and I'll take 70 to 72. And I've been pulled over before in the middle of the night by the state troopers for doing 70 miles an hour on there. Like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, there's no one out here. I was just driving, not thinking about it. But yeah, it's, you know, it's, we don't have that awareness anymore. We just, we lapse it so quickly.
Right.
We're like, oh, well, we're in our own little world. I'm going to do my thing. Who cares?
Right. And we're so easily to fall into illusions because it's the illusion of speed. You have no idea how fast you're going, and you have no idea how it's going to feel when you fucking hit something that's not going to move, you know, like a tree or a pole. You know, you're going 65 miles an hour and you hit something that's not going to move, like a rock or a wall, you're probably going to die. And that's not very fast, 65, or you think it's not very fast, you know?
Yeah. These days, we don't think it's very fast, but, you know, 100 years ago, people never moved at speeds like that.
Oh, no.
You know, the only thing that moved at speeds like that were cannonballs and musket balls, and they were shooting at you, and, you know, they tore apart lives. You know, outside of that, horses, you know, rarely exceed 35 miles an hour, even the fastest horses. You know, they might get a little faster, but, you know, that's like a good average speed for a horse, and that's what most people rode on for, you know, millennia.
And you can kill yourself on a horse going that fast.
Yeah,
if you hit a branch or you hit a pole, you know, you hit something.
Yeah,
you can really hurt the horse, and you can kill yourself just by going 30-25 miles an hour.
Yeah, and you know, we like to think that we're invincible, but, you know, human bodies, like, you know, we're hard and easy to kill at the same time. It doesn't take much to kill us.
Mm-hmm.
We can take a good beating, but, you know, it's, you hit something the right way and that's it. You know, one hit's all you get. You know, when you hit your head on a tree, you know, where you get thrown out of your car and you hit something head first, well, you're done. That's it. You know, you know, if you're lucky, you lose a leg instead of your life.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's always it's a great point of reference to talk about how humans would react to each other with no communication in high tense, high stress situations. And it's quite literally, we are void of courtesy, especially in Jersey. Just void, yeah. Just non-existent. One of the most dangerous spots on the parkway isn't the parkway itself, it's the on-ramps and the toll booths. Those are one of the most dangerous spots on parkways. And there's no courtesy. No courtesy. There's a reason why you don't pass on a right, and that's becoming more of like a socially accepted thing. It's to pass on the right. And you can really hurt someone that way. You know?
Yeah, well, you're completely blind. You really can't see anything on that other side of that car from the right because you're sitting on the left.
Right. There's a reason why you can kill yourself or someone else. And, you know, there's a situation. I work in pest control, so I drive all over the state all day, every day. So this is why I sit here and think about how humans react and respond based off of limited communication whilst driving. It's very easy for me to do that because I sit there and watch it all day.
Yeah, and people don't respond very well. You really see their true personalities and like where they're at mentally. Like, wow, you really are a piece of shit. Like,
right, like
a little bit of stress and you fly off the handle.
Right, like I've seen parents drop their kid off. You know, you're stopped at the school bus. The school bus goes. And the fucking guy cuts me off and he's speeding down the road. Like, what the... Like, or when a teacher comes out of... Fly, runs the stop sign, flying out of the school parking lot. Like, I'm in a Ford F-150 XL. I will really kill you. And there won't be a scratch on me. And I don't understand. Some like you go... It's like the pulmonologist that smokes cigarettes on her break. You know what I'm saying? Like, it just doesn't make sense sometimes to drive like an asshole. Especially if you're like some type of figure, you know, a teacher or a congressman or a political figure, whatever. It doesn't matter, you know? I've been cut off and brake checked by school, the little school vehicles, the minivans. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah.
What the?
it's truly insane to watch people drive. And like when you look at it, you're like, man, like you are just. Do you understand the hypocrisy you have in yourself right now? Like,
it's wild.
You're supposed to be responsible for other things, and you're just being an asshole and causing a bigger problem right now.
Yeah, I'd like to say that people are doing this consciously, but I don't even have faith on the fact that people can just shut off autopilot when they hop into a car. I feel like that's just the norm now, is people driving like maniacs around, especially around here.
Yeah, well, it's the conditioning. You get in the car here and you, or anything, you get in the habit of doing certain thing a certain way, and you hit that spot and you just revert back to that mentality. And you know, most of us, you know, we live our lives in a very reactionary state of mind, which is a very survival state of mind, not a very peaceful state of mind. We're always in survival mode, and you get out in the car and you can really see that, because people just react explosively to the tiniest little thing.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's an actual threat or not, they react explosively. And you know, nothing brings that more delight than sitting in traffic with someone and watching, like, people watching while you're driving.
Yes. Yes. It's enlightening, for sure. Yeah. And it, like, imagine, I say this on almost every podcast to almost every guest, imagine a world where we taught self-discipline and emotional intelligence as a cultural standard or a traditional standard. Doesn't even have to be cultural, just a traditional standard. Like, the American traditional standard is to teach a self-governing, self-disciplined person, is to give birth to adults like that. Yeah. What type of world? I would, that theory is, I predict literally 66% drop, 66.9% drop offs in things like addiction, suicide, domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, that's huge numbers. That's a, yep, that's a thick percentage. Way over 50%, you know?
Yeah. So culturally and societally, they don't want you to be good at self-regulating emotions and self-disciplining and self-governing, because people who are, you know, emotionally intelligent and self-disciplining and self-governing are hard to control.
Yes.
And society doesn't want people who are hard to control. They want people who are willing to conform, no questions asked. So they, you know, they removed those tools from schools that would teach you how to do that stuff, and they removed it from our culture and have put in place a, you're not responsible for anyone or anything, just sit here and stay numb.
Yes.
you're stressed, have a drink, you know.
Right.
Years ago, my buddy got married, was it 2013? And you know, because I was raised a Mormon, I'm not much of a drinker. I didn't start drinking, I had my first drink when I was almost 25 years old.
Wow.
And so, you know, when I get stressed, you know, I have a way of dealing with it that doesn't involve drinking or drugs of any kind, because I spent the first 25 years of my life learning how to handle stress and emotions myself without some kind of substance or kickstand or like something to lean on. Like I was always on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And when my buddy was getting married, I was the best man. I had to give a speech, and you know, I'm not good at public speaking. It doesn't matter if it's 100 people I know. You know, you put me up in a crowd in front of them, and I start speed talking. I start mumbling. You know, it just, I can't help it. And one of our friends was like, "Oh, you got to have a drink." I'm like, that's the last thing I want right now. That's not, but that was how he, you know, that's how most people these days deal with stressors. You know, they get stressed, have a drink. Do you feel this? You know, go grab your substance of choice to calm yourself down. Don't look for a way to do it in a healthy way to handle it. You know, whatever it is you need. It's just, what is it that you're using to calm yourself down? Yourself? How do you do that?
Right.
I can't tell you how many times I've heard in my life, you don't do anything to like zone out. I'm like, no, I've developed my own tools by not having these substances in my life to lean on. You know, is it better? Some ways I think it is. Does it always work great? No, because there are times where I'm trying to deal with it, I'm a very irritable and I'm a bastard. You know, but that's part of my process, unfortunately.
Yeah, it happens.
But you know, you let me get through it and I'm fine, but you have to let me get through my process. Most people these days, they don't even have that. Like if they get stressed, the only thing they think of is, wow, I need a drink. I had a really rough day. I just need a drink to calm down. No, you need to go take 5 minutes to yourself and go for a walk, do something.
Yes.
You know, but yes, society doesn't
leaving
want that.
The
you know,
house.
That's not what we're taught. At no point in time, you know, imagine schools are like, oh, you're feeling stressed. Why don't you go sit in that corner for a minute? Why don't you go for a walk around the school and come back in? You know, take a minutes to just kind of be by yourself and get your thoughts together. Take a few deep breaths. No, like, oh, you're feeling stressed? Here, just take a shot. You'll feel better.
Right. It's, I mean, even doing something as small as leaving the house, going outside, you know, being inside a structure, I don't even think we've evolutionarily responded to always being inside homes yet. You know,
that's still a new thing in human evolution.
Right. So our bodies, our central nervous system are still attuned to the outside world. So if you just simply, I mean, you may not realize it, but you're just feeling better just by going outside. And if the more industry that you remove from your sight and all of your senses, the better you feel. Mm-hmm. Like the deeper you go into the woods, the more you remove yourself, you know, the more I've gotten myself lost in Bamber Lake. I've in Double Trouble, and I've just wandered and know, the further you remove yourself, the further, the more you feel better, the more you feel,
the more at peace you feel,
right?
Like, the more, like, you can just let go. You're like, all right, and there's nothing around. You're not getting overstimulated,
right?
Because, you know, in our world today, like, we're constantly being bombarded by everything. So you have to find a way to remove yourself from that. And you can't go down the street. There's 14 billboards outside of every single strip mall. And you can't drive 5 minutes down the road in New Jersey without hitting a strip mall. You know? Right. So you have to get yourself away from that. You know, and the more you get away from that, the more you let your body relax. And the more, you know, the further out you get, the more your body does relax. It does respond right away to the lack of stimulation from the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the stimulation we have is not natural stimulation. And we're like birds, bees chirping, like you tune them out fairly quickly once you're out in the woods. You're like, all right, there's just some background noise of the woods. This is the sound of the woods. This is the sound of nature. They're soothing. You know, there's, you know, rain on your rooftop when you're sleeping at night is one of the easiest ways and best ways to stay asleep, because that white noise is a little bit of subtle noise. Mm-hmm. You know, traffic noise is not subtle and it's not easy to sleep through. It takes people years to sleep in a city where there's constant noise. You know, you out in the woods and they have no problem sleeping to the listening to the birds chirping and the bugs, you know, making noise at night. It's much more soothing to their nature, because it's still ingrained in our DNA that these are natural sounds that we're supposed to hear.
Right, right. It's wild. It's wild because imagine the nervous system responses that we're going to have in 100, 200 years from now. We might be, you know, directing ourselves into a serious just wave of mental illness and suffering and pain. And I just don't like the direction that our society is going. I don't like
it. No, and honestly, I think we're already there, because look at how many people can't handle regular stressors of life very well. I mean, you can't, at this point, you can't even talk to someone something that slightly challenges their own belief system without them exploding on you or just shutting down. Yeah. Like, you know, this is, are you so caught up in your own world that this is how things have to be that you can't even be open to something slightly different? It may not be necessarily negative or bad, it's just slightly different, and you guys just shut down and explode on people. Like, how dare you challenge my little paradigm world? Like, right. No, that's not, you know. And but I really think we've already hit that state of a very mentally ill society without realizing it. You know, the mass psychosis, people just, they can't see the world for what it is. They're so caught up in this little, their fake worlds on Facebook and on their phones, and they never break out of that. You know, and for me, it's hard to fathom how much worse we can get with this before we have an actual collapse, because I'm watching people have nervous breakdowns at younger and younger ages. And like, what is going on in your life that you're so stressed that your body is physically shutting down from it?
Yeah.
Like, we're already not healthy, like, to begin with that alone.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we're already there. We may have further to go. I hope not, but
yeah.
You know, I feel like looking at the world and the people I know in my own life that I've interacted with for years at work and stuff, I'm like, you used to be one way, and now I've seen you slowly change into a person that is unrecognizable from what you used to be, you know. And, you know, I know I've changed too, but, you know, we're supposed to change. And hopefully for the better, not getting more and more irritable and closer to having a nervous breakdown.
And what's really upsetting is the people who are spiritually sensitive, sensory sensitive, or people like me who are empathetic or have very sensitive to energy. We live in an environment that's not conducive for that type of growth. So that's where you find your drug addicts. That's where you find your severely mentally ill people. That's where you find people that just play video games all day. You know, in a different dimension, in a different world, you'd be like a fucking spiritual guru, my friend. Like, you would be one of the elders. Like, you would be the fucking top, the cream of the crop of, you know. But because of the environments we live in, that shit is just shoved so deep and into the darkest depths of the closet or wherever you want to shove it. Like, it's,
yeah,
it's mind blowing. The we're just so trapped,
Yeah. We're outliers of society. But I will say what does give me hope, because I've been doing vendor shows with our crystal business that we have, and the more I meet people, and I meet them individually and not in groups, the more people I realize, like, there are a lot more people who are truly open to this stuff. They're afraid to talk about it,
right?
Because it's so shunned in society. Because, you know, you watch TV and anything from Hollywood, anything spiritual is just considered woo-woo shit, and it's made fun of. It's never taken seriously, and that's, so people have this perception that's how everyone feels, and it's really not true.
Right.
You know, when you actually got there, you talk to the individual people and not people as groups, and you really find that more and more people are open to this to some level. And that is what gives me hope that there is a shift, because I've been meeting more and more people lately myself that are open to this, and some people that I would really not expect it from at all. You know, growing up as a Mormon, you know, my dad's one of 11 kids. He's number 5 out of 11, and, you know, half of his family is still very active in the Mormon church, and even they are very open to what I'm doing and very supportive, where, you know, 20 years ago that would not have been true with that family.
Right.
They would have been really much more closed-minded about it. And, you know, I'm happy to say my own family, I can see the difference, you know. And I've been doing vendor shows for over a year now, and the people I've been meeting at these shows, I'm like, wow, it's, you know, you were someone who I walked up here, I was like, oh, here we go, just another person looking for a pretty rock. And like, they really open up to you about it. I'm like, wow, all right, that was a good experience. I did not expect that from you.
Right.
That was very, very pleasant. And that has actually shifted my own perspective on how people do treat spirituality, realizing that most people are open to it. They're just afraid to admit it in front of people. You know, you get them one-on-one, and they are right there with me for more than half of what I have to say.
Yeah.
Or, you know, at least open and receptive to hearing what I have to say, as much as just closing it, tuning it out, and being dismissive. You know, you get them in front of their friends, and they switch personalities very quickly.
Right.
But one-on-one, they are much more open. That is what gives me hope, that we are, as a society, that people are encroaching more on this, because I think more and more people are also realizing that there are more people open to this, and that the, you know, shutting it out and tuning it out is not as conducive to their own well-being as it has been pushed.
Mm. Definitely, definitely an interesting journey, for sure.
Yes.
Definitely an interesting, let's see where we're at. We made it to just about 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Nice.
Yes, I'd say.
I did not feel like long at all. I felt like an hour conversation at best.
See, and this is why I'm doing this. I am a conversationalist. I love talking to people. I feel like I'm pretty easy to talk to. So I love talking to people. I love hearing their stories and what they're doing and what they have to say. Also love supporting my own theories. And, you know, I have an agenda too. Even though it's positive, and it's just, it's unfortunate because we live in a society that shuns chaos as well. Because even the positive parts are like, no, positive only positive.
No.
You know, you need to embrace your chaotic side a little bit. Like when I said I want to start doing it again. Go out into the woods and get lost, like actually get lost, because then you're feeling, and then you become at peace with being like, okay, I'm lost, but I'm all right. I'm okay. You know, I will find my way out of the, I got here. I'll get out. You know, it's almost like exposure therapy. You go and get, you know, embrace your chaos a little bit, because underneath the darkest parts of you are the most beautiful parts of you.
Yeah, they are. And they really are. And, you know, how would you know that it's really dark if there was no light, you know.
Right.
If you're only in love and light all the time, well, you're creating an imbalance in your own life. And at some point, all that negativity and chaos that you're ignoring is going to surface and it's going to erupt. And you have to feel it. You have to allow yourself to go to those dark spots, because without the light, there is no dark. And without the dark, there is no light. You know, it's just all monotone. And then that's not, what kind of life is that? That's not a life. You know, you have to have the ups and the lows. It's, you know, it's a wave.
Right. Right. So, so how would people get in contact with you?
I have a private Facebook group, White Hawk Spiritual Center.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can join. There are no questions to join. You just have to ask to join. And the reason for that is we are, my church, Turtle Moon Ministries, we are a PMA, which is a private ministerial association.
Mm.
And when you come to us, you're taking yourself out of the public realm, and it's what happens is between you and I. So the eyes of the government, state and federal, no longer exist. The laws don't apply. And this is all legal. It's actually protected by the 1st, 4th, 9th, and I think the 14th Amendments protect the right to private association, the right of private citizens to do what private citizens do in outside the public realm. So, you know, in there, we can talk about anything we want to talk about, with whatever Facebook doesn't censor, of course. But, you know, legally, though, when you come to us, we can talk about anything. And through that, I'm also, because I'm a shaman, I am the minister of the church, we also have that confidentiality. Anything you say to me in my ministerial capacity is between us anyway. But that allows us a lot more freedoms to talk about and dive into things that need to be talked about openly, mm-hmm. that is shunned by society. And so you can join the group, and they can hold me through there. That is the only way right now to get a hold of me, mm-hmm. is White Hawk Spiritual Center. And I think it is public to find, just private to join.
Okay. I'll have it in links and stuff and stuff and stuff. So that'll be easy. I think that was an amazing conversation. I think that, you know, think it's about a good time to wrap it up and such, and get about our day. I know you have some plans.
Yeah, I have to go to my in-laws for Easter and go hide Easter eggs still for my kids. Six-year-old and a 4-year-old.
Yes. It's always fun watching them look for it. You know?
It is. And my son's hilarious because he likes to follow my daughter. She's the oldest. He follows her around and then screams when he doesn't find anything. Well, you know, you have to go your own direction, kid. Like, you can't just follow your sister. So it's watching. I enjoy watching the interaction between the two of them. As frustrating as it may be when they're having their fits,
but yeah,
it is so entertaining.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on, and you have a great rest of your weekend and a great day.
You too. Thank you. Right,
thank you so much.
Bye.
All right. That was my interview with Jonathan Whitehawk. I think that went well. I think so. That was an absolutely amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And yeah, that's it. Y'all have a good day now. Stay lifted. I need y'all to have a great fucking day and stay lifted. Go drink some coffee. Smoke some weed if you don't like coffee. There's another studio out there called Vaping Tea. I was there once. Like to get there again. Vape and Tea LLC, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, I'm going now. You guys have a great day. Love y'all. Stay lifted.